sevenfold was so far away. It went from 3-1 this week on the Sideshow Countdown. That's it for me and Carrie. Time to pack it up and head to another city. We'll be back next week with more rock, more road stories, plus some six picks, a blast from my past, and a hell of a lot of music. I'm Nikki Sixx.
I'm Carrie Kasem.
See you next weekend.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead. Stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Yes, we are. Hey, Julene. Oh, I mean, this is the... I got to turn
Hi,
the mic
here.
I'm new at this. Got you on the air. You know what Freud, says is no such thing as accidents.
Yeah, what's up? What's going on
nothing,
with that?
Nothing. I'll have to ask my shrink.
Okay.
I don't have a shrink.
No?
But I want to, you know, that would be nice, though. Talk to somebody, wouldn't give you a hard time.
Right, true.
You tell them all the weird thoughts you have in your mind.
And they just go with it.
Yeah, yeah. So why do you want to, you know, like anybody else you told it to, they would go, ah, you know, they would never talk to you.
Give me your money.
Well, hey, yeah, that is, they are getting paid. Welcome to the broadcast, a significant night tonight. You know, a lot of generations remember exactly where they were when historic events occurred, mm-hmm. like Katrina or 2001, September 11th, 2001. Yeah. Going back, what else?
When Kennedy
was
shot,
the beginning of World War II. John Lennon died. Thank you. Yeah.
Or was killed, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I wonder, is this going to be a night?
No.
You don't think so?
I don't think so.
July 31st,
no.
2011, when the fate of America's middle class and working class and poor were finally sealed, where the race to the bottom is indisputably that it's going down. We're not going up. Bernie, you know, here's what happened, by the way, ending a perilous stalemate. President Barack Obama and congressional leaders announced historic agreement Sunday night, that's tonight, on emergency legislation to avert the nation's first ever financial default.
Historic. I like that. Yeah. Historically horrible.
Yeah, the agreement would slice at least $2.4 trillion from federal spending over a decade, a steep price for many Democrats, too little for many Republicans. Of course, the Republicans had to give up a lot. What did they give up?
I don't think they gave up much, did they?
Here's what Senator Bernie Sanders said. Independent, he's not a Democrat, of Vermont, issued the following statement after he voted against a Senate deficit reduction proposal. Pardon me. The Republicans have been absolutely determined to make certain that the rich and large corporations not contribute one penny for deficit reduction and that all of the sacrifice comes from the middle class and working families in terms of cuts in Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, community health centers, education, Head Start, nutrition, affordable housing, and many other vitally important programs. Senator Sanders says, I cannot support legislation like the Reid proposal. That's the head of the Democrats in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
His proposal, which balances the budget on the backs of struggling Americans while not requiring one penny of sacrifice from the wealthiest people in our country. That is not only grotesquely immoral, says Senator Sanders, it is bad economic policy.
Bernie Sanders is great, and he also says that Obama needs a strong opponent on, the Democrat side in this upcoming election.
How about Senator Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, I know there's a lot of people throw that around out there in the
draft
political circle.
Bernie. Yeah. I mean,
draft.
yeah. Anyway, this is Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Our number here is 313-298-WRIF, and here's the important one.
What? Oh, 313-298-9743. And we're on Facebook talking about a lot of this right now. I basically just said we're screwed. And so come on in and join us in there and give your opinion. If you know, a lot of people don't want to call the show, although we want you to.
Yeah, friends want it.
You can come on Facebook. It's the easy way these days, right?
Facebook.com/nightcall. Yeah, we'll never have to have personal interaction again.
Although we want it. We encourage it. Yes.
And it's calltalkyes at yahoo.com for email. Calltalkyes at yahoo.com. This so-called deal, this settlement, this compromise is such a scam on the part of the Republicans that it just defies the imagination.
Yeah, I find myself thinking, how in the hell is this happening? How did this happen?
I mean, how can the Democrats be so lame? How can President Barack Obama show such little leadership? You know, Harry S. Truman back, I don't know, maybe late 40s or something like that, he was denouncing the Republicans in the Congress, and he has, you know, you can read this in your history books, and he said, I can't remember what it is, the do nothing, good for nothing. I don't think someone remembers this better than me. I had it in my brain, the do nothing, good for nothing, 86 Congress or whatever it was, denouncing the Republicans, where Barack Obama has sounded, he says, I asked both parties, like he's not a member of one of them.
Yeah, I know, it's like he's a mediator.
Yeah, and some dude has got his ear and said, you know, we can't appear too radical. We can't say.
Yeah. Do you think it has anything to do with race?
Well,
partially. Partially.
What do you mean?
I think that he wants to be accepted with all the racism out there. That.
Oh, you think that's like a personal motivator?
Yeah.
I don't know. I hadn't even thought about it. I only think of political.
It might be. I know.
No, I don't. I'm only kidding. No, that's very possible. I mean, but you know what? I think he mainly wants to, his whole mind, here's what it's all about. This whole deficit, raising the limit for this. It is about the Republicans trying to hurt Barack Obama so he can't get reelected.
Yeah.
And Barack Obama trying to do stuff that will get him elected.
It's all politically motivated.
But it's not. You know, the people that got Barack Obama elected were exactly the base. The people that were so motivated by the idea that he represented something new, something vibrant, something that had, quote, hope attached to it, mm-hmm. something that had, quote, change attached to it. And what we got and what we have is Republican light. In fact, now with this, not even Republican light. It's like teabagger light or something
terrible.
Like that.
Terrible.
Yeah. Hey, weigh in on this. 313-298-9743. You know, here's the deal. Raising the debt limit is housekeeping. You know how many times it's been done since 1960?
Yeah, this happens.
All the time.
All the time. I think people, a lot of people have come out of their, I don't know, cloud of not knowing anything. And now all of a sudden, because people are paying attention, they think they know what they're talking about, but they still don't.
Yeah, 78 times the debt limit has been raised since 1960, 49 times under Republican presidents, 29 times under Democratic presidents. The Obama administration has taken pains to note that President Ronald Reagan, a hero to many Republicans, raised the debt limit, I actually don't have the figure here, numerous times, 8 maybe or something like that. So it is simply a housekeeping procedure. And here's what I mean. A budget is passed, and then the Congress says, okay, how do we get the money to and this is the way it's been, you know, forever. This is, or at least
this
for the last 100 years. Yeah. So we don't have enough revenue coming in, so the money is borrowed, right? And so we get to a point where, well, we got to borrow more. We're not going to be able to meet the budget obligations we've already established. So then the debt limit is raised, and then more money is borrowed. This is never an item like this.
Yeah.
This is purely political. And why the Democrats? What fools? What charlatans these people are?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know what's going to happen? The Republican base, I mean, remember, they never get deterred from how corrupt and scandalous and hypocritical and every other, you know, insane actions that the people on their side, they're out, oh, yeah, they're cool. Whereas Democrats that have this high ethical quality to their decision making, you know, they're going to all say, and maybe me too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, listen, these guys are so far from what I want. They have so failed to meet the minimum of what you would think an opposition. Well, they're not even an opposition. What am I saying? An opposition party. They're not an opposition party. They're the governing party. And they just every time caved. Or as I think on my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com, PeterWerbe.com. There is an article there. Let me go to it quickly.
And, Peter, it was 49 times that the debt limit has been extended, altered, 49 times under Republican presidents, 29 times under Democratic presidents.
How many times for old Ronald Reagan?
Ronnie, I don't have to find that.
I think we have the same one. Oh, yeah, this is, my old pal Jeff Cohen, who was the founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting on CommonDreams.org on July 24th. He said Obama is not caving to corporate interest. He says that that Obama, like the rest of them, is a corporatist.
Mm-hmm.
Acts
yes,
out the
absolutely.
Agenda of the corporations. I mean, that's the nature of the political system. That's the nature of the electoral system. You need that probably is going to wind up spending, $1 billion to attempt to get reelected. But what it really is all about, and we've talked about this any number of times, I mean, why did we go from surplus to debt? Well, it's George W. Bush.
Figure.
It's Reaganomics. It's deregulation that allowed these banksters and these corporate thieves to ruin the economy.
Yeah, speaking of corporatists, got to throw a little Clinton in there.
Yeah,
the mix,
absolutely.
Right? Sprinkle of that.
And but there are liberal corporatists like Obama and the Democratic Party that aren't ferociously homophobic and racist
right. And
all the worst attributes that Americans show. In fact, Democrats and on the social side have all the best qualities. You know, and I'm talking about the individuals. I'm talking about, like my parents and my sister, people like that, my friends and what have you. I'm not talking about the Democratic Party politicians. Some of them are decent. John Conyers, Dennis Kucinich.
Sure. Yeah. Bernie Sanders.
He's an independent.
Oh, that's right. He is. I always forget that.
Yeah.
I always forget. And I've listened to, he has a little segment every week. On
Tom Hartman.
On our friend's show, yeah. Listen to him every week, yeah. He's great.
Yeah. Comment on this if you'd like. 313-298-9743. Well, here's the deal. All right, so you have all these wars that are costing trillions. I mean, that's what begins to sink us. You have this deregulation that allows such corporate and banking and finance shenanigans that the economy collapses. Thank you, George Bush and the Republicans and Reaganomics. You have a tax cut for the wealthy. We used to call it the Bush tax cut. Why don't we call it the Bush/Obama tax
sure,
cut?
It should be.
He signed on to it.
Yeah.
What was the matter with this guy? He said, and here, as always, the Republicans holding the country hostage, and they were saying, we're going to cut off unemployment benefits if you don't extend. Imagine this. People that are unemployed, people that are hurting so badly.
Are they supposed to do?
Yeah, not only financially, but psychologically.
Absolutely.
The hurt that this brings them. And these Republicans are saying, either you got to extend the tax cuts to the wealthiest people in the country or screw those people.
Yeah, and I mean, as if these people aren't already stressed out enough.
So why didn't Obama go to the wall with these bastards?
Yeah, he didn't even hesitate. Sadly.
He did.
He didn't. Yeah. He pretended to, Peter.
Corporate taxes have dropped so much in the last half century. Here, Sam Pizzagatti, who's commentating, go to rootsaction.org. If corporations and households amassing $1 million or more in income each year were now paying taxes at the same annual rate as they did in 1961, the federal treasury would be collecting an additional $716 billion a year. So this is one of the reasons. I mean, then do that times 50, right? I can't even do it. It's too many zeros.
I need to bring a calculator.
Yeah. In other words, if the federal government started taxing the wealthy and their corporations at the same rates in effect a half century ago, the federal debt to investors would almost totally disappear over the next decade. Huh? How about that? All we got to do is raise the tax on the wealthy. Raise taxes on the wealthy, not on the middle class, not on workers, not on the poor.
And it's obviously not like it even will, of course, it will make a dent, but not the dent that, it won't even matter to these people.
Well, here we have, I don't know.
Except emotionally.
Oh, yeah, they'll get angry and they'll start financing the teabaggers. And that's, that's what they do.
Uh-huh.
I mean, imagine these ultra-wealthy people financing these right-wingers to get them better tax breaks and to roll back environmental regulations.
Yeah, it's like they're little marionettes.
Oh, here it is.
On a string.
The 400 richest Americans have a total wealth of $1.5 trillion.
That's it
four. 400 people in this country, the richest, have between them in wealth $1.5 trillion.
Wow.
Yeah, the top 10 have $270 billion between them. Now,
but is it enough, Peter? Is it enough?
No, not for them. Yeah. But here, look at it like this. If I said to you, I was going to take away 60% of your income and your wealth.
Oh, man.
I would hurt you so badly.
So bad.
Right?
Yeah, I'd go down.
You go down, right.
Absolutely.
If you took 90% of the wealth and income of these people, you know what would change about their life? Nothing. Nothing. Nothing would change.
Their egos.
Yeah.
Come on.
It wouldn't hurt them. So here's what we ought to do. We ought to raise the taxes significantly on the wealthy, confiscate this impacted wealth, this $1.5 trillion that's just sitting around in that big crap game in the sky. By the way, the 40 states that are in debt, including Michigan, mm-hmm. have a combined debt of only $125 billion. So, I mean, some of these guys a few of them could write a check.
Absolutely.
Bang, boom, yeah.
Right.
Here's what's happening, though.
If I had that money, I'd write that check.
Yes. The good news and the bad news for the middle class. Ooh, well, here's the bad news for the middle class. I don't have any good news today.
Yeah, okay.
Roy Roberts, who is the emergency manager for the Detroit Public Schools, had just signed an executive order on Friday that imposed $81 million in wage concessions on workers starting in August. Wait. He just signed an order saying that we're cutting your pay by 10%. Man, those people need a union. Oh, no, they have a union.
That's right.
They have a contract.
Yeah, that's what this emergency management does.
Under this law, yeah, that Governor Snyder, no wonder people want him recalled. So get this. He, with the stroke of a pen and, of course, the support of Governor Rick Snyder.
And not a second thought.
Yeah. Well, they had a second thought.
You know.
They wanted to do 15.
Right.
Yeah,
it was higher. Okay.
Yeah. Union leaders called the new law an attempt to bust public unions, do you think? And pledged to fight for their contracts in court. Well, please do. And the head of the teachers union, Keith Johnson, promised to file suit. There we go. Where is that? Oh, yeah. The lowest paid union workers will now earn at or near minimum wage, said Keith. Keith January, rather, different guy, president of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Local 435. In other words, these are union workers, and they're going to now earn at or near the minimum wage. And they represent about 1,400 DPS food service workers, technicians, and bus attendants. The average worker in the union earns about $20,000 a year. Wayne State University just announced it's eliminating 200 positions. And the president of Wayne State, President Alan Gilmore, said, this note is to inform you, he wrote to employees, that today we begin a reduction in force. You know what a reduction in force is? A riff.
Firing.
It's a riff.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a different risk.
Yeah.
Altogether.
And notify the affected employees. The decision was necessitated by a $32 million reduction in state funding, the largest cut in our history. So the state, Rick Snyder. So I don't understand why, you know, there's not thousands and thousands of Wayne State students and thousands of workers out on this. What it all amounts to, the percentage of U.S. adults who believe it is possible for themselves and their families to achieve the American dream has dropped to 50%.
Jeez.
I mean, there's really 50% of you that still think, whoa, we can achieve the American dream. Faith in the American dream falls even further when respondents are asked if it's possible for middle-class families to achieve it, down to just 44% today.
Yeah. Grim. You know what? I'd like to hear from those people who voted for Rick Snyder and who still stand by their decision. And if you voted and now you're, you know, looking back going, man, I really screwed up on this one, I'd like to hear from you too. I'm not going to scold you or anything, but, you know, this guy's bad. He's bad for the people of Michigan.
And there's a major recall effort going on.
Major effort. I mean,
just go to, I think it's
what's
just
the
recall.
Hope of that, I wonder. Recall Rick. There's a big Facebook one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're all over the place.
Let me see. I actually have it. Go to my website, peterwerbe.com. Now, here, how about the good news and the bad news for the rich?
Wait, there's only good news.
Well, the good news was this so-called compromise. I don't know. I mean, I don't understand.
With
the debt ceiling. I don't know what the Democrats got out of it. And the Democrats are supposed to be representing the average people of this country.
Whatever.
Yeah. But here, all right. Well, here's the good news.
Okay.
Governor Paul LePage of Maine, he's the nutball that took down that mural in the Labor Department of Maine.
Because yes, he said it was there for how many years?
Not that long.
Oh, but it was a labor mural that he wanted gone.
You know what? It was in the Labor Department anyway.
Right.
Governor Paul LePage of Maine happened to be waiting for his flight at Augusta State Airport on a recent Saturday when the weekend crush began. A turboprop PC-12 carrying Melissa Thomas, her daughter's friend, and a pile of lacrosse equipment took off for their home in Connecticut following the girls' three-week stay at Camp All-Star in nearby Kent Hills, Maine. Shortly after, a Cessna Citation XL arrived, and a mother and a father and their 13-year-old daughter emerged carrying a pink sleeping bag and two large duffel bags, all headed to Camp Vega in Fayette. Love it, love it, love it, Mr. Page said. The governor said of the private plane traffic generated by summer camps. For decades, parents in the Northeast who sent their children to summer camp faced the same arduous logistics of traveling long distance to remote towns in Maine, New Hampshire, and upstate New York to pick up their kids or to visit. Now, even as the economy limps along, more of the nation's wealthier families are cutting out the car ride and chartering planes to fly to summer camp.
Okay.
One private jet broker, Blue Star Jet, said the summer camp business had jumped 30% over the last year. Now, you get what's going on here?
Yeah, life is good for that less than 2%.
For the middle class, for the working class, it's down.
Yeah.
It's going down. It's a race to the bottom. For these people, one guy said, we have 50 to 60 jets up here in just one day. Anything new on here?
My parents threw me in the back of the wood paneled station wagon and dropped my ass off at Camp Sacagawea.
At Sullivan County Airport in Bethel, New York, roughly 40% of recent flights have carried families heading to summer camp. There's bad news for the wealthy, though.
Oh, okay. Lay it on me.
A high-end prostitution ring catering to Wall Street clients who often would spend over $10,000 for a night binging on sex and cocaine has been busted. 17 people indicted.
Brooklyn. Lovely. Well, they need to blow off some steam, Peter, whether it's $10 or $10,000.
Brooklyn District Attorney Charles Hines said the business of high-end prostitution is enormously profitable. He added the ring had earned more than $7 million over 3 years. Clients often spend in excess of $10,000 in a single night. All high-end customers coming from the financial markets. People with nothing but money. I mean, this is a parallel universe for real. You know, they're on some other planet.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's enough of them to make the economy spin around, at least in this weird bubble that they exist in. They were open 24 hours a day, charged from $400 to $3,600 an hour. What do you get for that?
Think about this one.
Yeah. Good news for the wealthy. General Electric, second quarter profits up 21%. Remember, last quarter they paid no tax whatsoever.
It's good to be GE.
Yeah. And as the foreclosures continue, how about this? The real estate market in the U.S. has a new prize in the category of the most expensive property. A $175 million ranch located outside of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Despite the curiosity, the luxury real estate market is booming in America and elsewhere in the world. Now, if you live, well, even if you live in some of the upscale, upper middle class suburbs like Northville or what else is around?
Bloomfield Hill.
They have a high, all these McMansions that people bought at these extraordinary inflated prices, like in, the middle of the decade, last decade. There's high foreclosures in those areas. Yet one does not have to venture far from Jackson Hole to find another high-priced luxury estate. The neighboring Walton Ranch is listed for $100 million. The famed Hearst Estate, once listed for $165 million in 2007, is still up for grabs at $95 million. I mean, this is... You know,
those poor babies.
And, wait, you know what? I think I threw that away too quickly, that thing about Detroit, the school system.
Okay.
I can't grab it fast enough. But that's, you know, we're talking about with these homes, that's what the Detroit school budget is all about.
It's what it needs.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. The deficit.
A house for all of these thousands of children's lives, their futures.
And it goes on. South Florida, the default capital of the country here in Miami-Dade County, one out of five houses with mortgages in foreclosure. Nearly 200,000 South Florida families are stuck in the mire of default. But increasingly, after a brutal drop during this first 6 months of the year, there were 439 sales of homes for at least $2 million.
Yeah. Well, there's some nice homes down there in South Florida. I lived there.
So the question is, where is the equal sacrifice? What are the rich sacrificing? Wouldn't you say that it's hovering around zero? So let's go back to this. Let's go back to what we can do. First off,
are you connecting the dots,
yes.
Peter? Okay.
End all these wars immediately. Withdraw all the American bases from overseas. Cut the defense budget in half. Tax the hell out of the ultra wealthy and the corporations. Make sure, you know, if they are, I mean, because they know that that all these companies have this offshore tax shelters.
Little loopholes there.
Yeah. So, and you know, all the deductions for them and that, all the subsidies to like the oil companies and what have you, and all that. And you know what? No problem. And then what you can do, you can raise Social Security. They're talking about cuts in Social Security, even in the Social Security cost of living. You know, there's some elderly people living all by themselves on $750.
Yes. Many a month. So cutting that.
These rich scumbags are paying, what was it, $3,800 an hour to have, I can't say what they're doing.
Something serious.
Yeah. I don't know. I can't even imagine.
We can talk about it during the break.
Yeah. Oh, you have some ideas?
A couple rolling around.
Really?
You know.
You know what I'm looking for right now? I can't seem to find it.
I can multitask during this
show. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. This is Bill Maher. And let me see if we can get him on here just for a few minutes right up to our break. So, Bill, take it away.
Tonight. I'm going to put on my teabagger hat. Thank you. And admit, they are right about one thing. We have to bring down the national debt. It's insane what the debt costs America every year. We pay about $400 billion just in interests. That's almost as bad as having a credit card with Capital One. But the problem with the Tea Party movement, besides their almost universal rejection of dentistry, is that they want money for nothing and chicks for free. They want a deregulated free market and their jobs to stay here in the U.S. They want guaranteed health coverage regardless of pre-existing conditions, but without a big government mandate. They want to call themselves teabaggers and people to keep a straight face. And, of course, they want big tax cuts along with deficit reduction. I can't even think of a suitable analogy for that disconnect. It's like thinking getting a hand job will clean your garage. Now, in fairness, this isn't just the teabaggers. Ask the American people how they want to tame the deficit. By raising taxes or cutting spending. And cutting spending wins. Always, by a huge margin. Next question. So what government spending do you want to see cut? Answer, nothing. Not a thing. America is like a family that spends way more than they bring in. But Mom won't give up her shopping sprees, and Dad won't give up that big, stupid boat he bought. Even now, when we utterly can't afford a big, stupid boat. And you know what America's stupid boat is? It's our empire. We have an empire. We have 500,000 of our troops in other people's countries all over the world. That is our boat. And maintaining that empire and everything that goes into defense costs us about $1 trillion a year, most of which goes to fighting the Russians in 1978. Fighter planes for all those dogfights we get into with the Taliban. Submarines to foil their evil plot to blow up our ships with car bombs. And space lasers to shoot down their exploding underpants. What defense spending really is a giant welfare program, a jobs program for defense workers to build crap we don't need. So when teabaggers scream about handouts, this is what they should be protesting. We spend more on weapons than the next top 15 military powers combined. Let's cut it in half so we only spend as much as the next 8 countries combined and see if anyone invades us. So teabaggers... teabaggers, if you look into that... I will believe you really are, we the people, what about our grandchildren, patriots. But if you're unwilling to cut defense and give up the empire, you don't really care about the debt. And you have to admit, you're just a racist, sore loser. Here's your hat.
Bill Maher, wow. You're listening to Tonight Call on WRF. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan with you. And, hey, let's take a break right now. I've got some people waiting. Hang on. We'll get you on the air right after the break. We're going to let you guys speak. Yeah. Here's the number.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
We're college roommates turned real-life roommates.
Peas in a pod.
And still BFFs.
We even got the same car insurance discounts from Esurance.
I got my discounts on their website.
But I got mine over the phone from this awesome Esurance agent.
Like, how awesome?
Like, half as awesome as you.
Awesome.
For awesome car insurance discounts, get a quote today at Esurance.com or 1-800-ESURANCE. Esurance. Technology when you want it. People when you don't. Not available in all states. Some restrictions apply. Discounts may vary by state. See site for details.
Awesome.
Are you ready to do something about your high credit card debt? Tired of paying double-digit interest rates, late fees, over-limit fees? It's time to stop the madness. Get out of debt the safe and affordable way with Credit Card Relief. With Credit Card Relief, there are no upfront fees, no monthly maintenance fees, and no settlement fees. You don't pay anything until a debt is settled, all with a 90-day money-back guarantee. That's Credit Card Relief, managed by local attorneys in-state, with workout plans tailored to your debt situation. Get out of debt in months instead of years, all while saving thousands in future bank fees. Call the original Credit Card Relief, where the consultation is free and the results are real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282.
One little fish oil pill. You know this powerful little pill is great for your heart, that it's great for your joints. It even has powerful benefits for your skin and brain function. But the fish oils of today are sadly incomplete because they don't contain the super antioxidant power of clinically proven krill oil that can increase joint comfort by 28% in just 7 days. Until now. Introducing the free bottle giveaway of Krill Omega-3 from Purity Products, our most powerful fish oil formula ever. The only thing our advanced Krill Omega-3 fish oil is missing is the price. Because right now, we're offering anyone a full-size bottle of our krill oil as part of a nationwide free trial. Just call 1-800-950-5868. To request yours, you can't go to stores. The only way to get your free bottle is to go to the phone. The number is 1-800-950-5868. Call now and claim your bottle absolutely free. 1-800-950-5868. That's 1-800-950-5868.
My mom is my hero. She goes into burning buildings. She finds people inside who need to be saved. She helps them get out, even when she can't breathe or see or is a little scared. My mom is a firefighter, but the best thing she can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration reminds you to protect yourself and firefighters. Have smoke alarms on every level and near sleeping areas. Test them monthly. Change batteries as instructed. Install sprinklers. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, most fire deaths occur in homes with no working smoke alarms. The good news is, that's a fact we can change. Smoke alarms save lives. Find out more at usfa.dhs.gov.
Yes. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Eat the rich. That's our solution. Hey, they're eating us. It is a defense against the class warfare practiced by the Republican stooges of the ultra wealthy and the corporations. And so the only we got to bring them to heel. They brought us to heel. The debt ceiling gets raised all the time. According to a caller, President Reagan raised the debt ceiling 18 times. It's a housekeeping measure. It's about how do you administer the budget already passed. In the budget for the future, that's where you determine what is going to be spent. And the Republicans were able to get out of the spineless Democrats. This was passed tonight, by the way, if you didn't know that. Mm-hmm. They were able to get out of the Democrats something they never could have gotten legislatively. So.
Right. And I think all these baggers, you know, who didn't know anything before and they got all fired up about this. Now they're just, they've got Obama on a microscope. Now they're paying attention. They still don't know what they're talking about.
There you go. You had an email for us, did you say?
Yeah, I do. Stephen Farmington Hills. I believe the Republicans will win the White House and the Senate in 2012. If so, the first thing they'll do is cut taxes on the rich from 35% to 25%, defund Obamacare, and make draconian cuts to Social Security and Medicare. They'll also be in control of all three branches of government when the next debt ceiling is hit, and they will destroy this country like never before. He said he's 52 years old. He really sees no future at all for the United States. We're feeling a little bit down ourselves.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm going to play the old there's a Sex Pistols song called No Future.
Oh, yeah. Feeling that way. And by the way, give a call, 313-298-WRIF.
Yeah, here's Jim in Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, Jim, welcome to the broadcast.
Hi, how you doing?
We're good.
You were talking earlier about lowering the debt, which I think is right now at our country's time, I think is probably the best thing for us. If we don't, I think we're going to fall off a cliff. I think I live in Jacksonville, Florida, which is primarily a huge Navy town,
right?
Where the Third Fleet is here, and we've got a couple of submarine bases here. There's a Marine Corps base here, so we're quite heavily armed forces here.
Okay,
and I would say probably 90% of the people here are Republican. It's a rather red state in a red area here in Jacksonville.
Well, it's not really a red state. I mean, Florida went for Obama in 08, and it went for Gore in 2000. I mean, the Republicans had to steal the election in Florida. So, but go ahead.
That's true.
But there's some pretty concentrations.
Yeah, there is. Red,
yeah. Yeah, I guess it's kind of purple.
Yeah, there you go.
But do you think, I mean, we spend a lot of money overseas. My cousin right now is serving in Afghanistan, the Marine Corps. Before that, he was stationed in Japan. Do we really need all of I mean, we got bases in Germany.
According, you know, depending on how you count it, we've got somewhere between 700 and 900 bases overseas. And these are figures that come from the Republican Ron Paul, who's running for president. And I don't know how there's that gap. I mean, you know, why is there 700 to 900? But there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. No other country in the world has like an Africa command, you know, a European command, an Asian command, all that stuff. I mean, this is insane. I mean, that's what Bill Maher was talking about in that clip that I just played. We have this enormous empire. And I've made this point before. I always forget the guy's name. He's a conservative historian. His last name is Kennedy. And it's something like The Rise and Fall of Great Empires. I'm not even 100% sure of the title, but it's something close to that. And his contention is that every empire that ever existed, from Rome to Britain and now the U.S., collapses because it overextends itself militarily and by definition has to do so financially. Because when you have these enormous armies and you have, I mean, you have the military taking $1 trillion a year. I mean, why isn't there this huge effort made to disarm the world rather than the United States now is selling, what is it, like 35 fighter jets to Iraq?
Yeah, well,
where are they getting the money?
We're arming the world.
Yeah, yeah. So why aren't we disarming the world? Why aren't we trying to sign peace treaties, non-aggression treaties with China and with Russia? Who else? I don't even know who else could do anything. Why don't we sign this final peace treaty with North Korea and all that? I mean, it is in the vested interest of lots of people in this country to maintain this militaristic empire. I mean, we don't see much of it. We see on, you know, we know there's a war going on. A few guys get killed every week, you know, like that. The only people that are really aware of it are the military and the military families, the people that actually make the sacrifice because of these misguided policies. So that's number one. That's number one where all the cuts should come from. And we ought to talk about, I mean, rebuilding this country, free college tuition. There's a million things we could do that the government could stimulate the economy. And modern capitalism will not work without massive government stimulation. I mean, it almost collapsed. And if it wasn't for, I hate to say it, for George Bush, I mean, he created it. I mean, he created the thing. But for the, you know, the bailouts and the stimulus, that saved perhaps even world capitalism.
Yeah, George Bush stimulated the military-industrial complex to levels unknown to mankind.
And for those of you who are saying, wait a minute, I don't want to save capitalism. I mean, it never worked. I mean, it worked well for some people in some parts of the world sometimes, and it doesn't do real well for lots of people most of the time across the world, even, you know, in individual countries. But the kind of collapse that would have occurred had not that Bush then Obama moved in to clean up what their buddies, the banksters and the other financial guys had done, this would have been a pretty ugly scene. It's not a matter of supporting that. I mean, you would say, well, hey, let the banks collapse. Who cares? Well, there'd have been some drastic problems.
Yeah, you think it's bad now.
Yeah. All right, Jim, thank you very much. Appreciate you calling from so far away. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Jeremy in Waterford. Hi, Jeremy. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
It's going good. What's up?
All right, well, after the conversation progressed, I got a few things to say.
Sure, go ahead.
Well, I feel you can't just stimulate the country. You can't just openly force back this money. So I feel as if the government would completely cut spending, then they would give them a chance to bank all of this money and slowly pay off our debt rather than just forcing it back into the economy, because a lot of people didn't earn this money. They're not going to be spending it necessarily on what they should be.
Hey, Jeremy, I mean, what would you cut?
It would just be more of just holding on to the money that they have. It would be mostly military, I'd say.
I mean,
in my opinion, it would almost all be military.
Yeah. Well, what they have found out is what I was saying to the caller before you from Jackson. They found out that modern capitalist economies cannot exist without massive government intervention of wealth transfer from private citizens through the government and then spending. So the question is, what are you going to spend it on? You're going to spend it on military machines, things that aren't, you know, that aren't socially useful, that eventually, you know, cause death and destruction, that are capital intensive rather than labor intensive, so not that many people get hired. And I mean, the deal is, and I don't have the facts at my fingertips, but it's generally like this. If you spent like $1,000, let's say, on the military-industrial complex, you'd get, I don't know if I can pose it like this, but you get less people working within. Think about, you know, construction of military aircraft. I mean, that is a highly skilled workforce, and not very many of them. Highly automated and what have you. Start talking about people trying to repair the infrastructure or build, for instance, in Michigan, a system of, say, ferries across Lake Michigan, mm-hmm. Lake Huron, and things that would really be good for people.
Well, the fast rail, they talked about
yeah.
those kind
How
of
about
things.
Schools, you know? So
yeah.
we got 15...
Let's start with yeah. GPS.
Yeah. In other words, so that our school teachers in the city of Detroit and other schools wouldn't have to take cuts, but in fact, we'd have to hire hundreds and hundreds more because we were going to say we're going to mandate no more than 15 kids in a class and we're going to have the best of everything for them. You say, well, gee, we don't have the money. Well, somebody's got the money. This is the richest country in the world. And you know who it is? The guys that are spending $3,800 an hour in a whorehouse that just yep. got busted in New York
yeah,
City.
Uh-huh.
So eat the rich. I mean, they're eating us. It's eat or be eaten. And you know what? The average person in this country is not greedy. Because, you know, if we said we could take all the money from the rich, every penny they've got, people go, well, gee, that's not fair. We don't want to do that. Let's take a guy who's got, $30 billion. Take $29 billion. He's got $1 billion. He can do everything he wants. He can buy those $145 million homes out in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. He can buy politicians, still all that. I mean, everything for him remains the same. But these guys are plotting. You know, the teabaggers are just these useful idiots for the ultra wealthy and the corporations doing their bidding, who have created this movement that's going to allow them to have more and more tax cuts. In other words, if you cut spending, then you don't need as much money coming into the government, right? So then you can lower taxes. Well, if you cut 5% off of, say, my taxes, it doesn't amount to much. If you do it off one of these millionaires or billionaires, that's a whole lot. So these people are psychos. They've got so much money. Why aren't they thinking how they can get more money to people? Why doesn't somebody like even, I gotta say, I think he's the 10th richest guy in the country, Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And he's donating $50 million to the Sierra Club, the environmental group, to a grassroots campaign to block the construction of new coal-fired power plants and shut down existing ones. It's because they're one-third of the emissions of carbon dioxide. He also pledged $20 million to C40, a group of cities around the world that are trying to reduce greenhouse gases.
Well, I'm glad that he's doing some of that because we've been talking about how much money he makes and how he could fix Detroit today.
Yeah, he's number 10. He's worth $18 billion. So when you give $70 million, it doesn't even touch it.
Yeah.
Doesn't even touch it.
Don't even notice it.
Yeah, we'll
life
see.
Life goes on.
Alice Walton, who never worked a day in
Walmart,
her life.
Walmart, yeah.
Walmart, yeah, worth $20 billion. She is like creating this multi-million dollar art institute, this museum
mm-hmm.
in her town, Bentonton, Arkansas, of American art. And I forgot, it's like $215 million, but it doesn't even touch it.
Yeah.
So you could confiscate, under the laws, like $19 billion from her. She's not hurt at all. She can still have her museum. She can still take her kids to camp in a private jet.
She can still ruin people's lives yeah. by employing them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And make sure that nobody ever gets to unionize at Walmart so she can keep making her billions.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This is class one. War, folks, except we're just the collateral damage. We don't have an army. The teabaggers are the army of the ultra-wealthy and the corporations. The Republicans are the command center of it all. And they are waging massive class warfare upon us. And we say, well, please, sir, don't... no, I won't. Never mind. I was going to say something. I won't even say that. Did you know what I was going to say? All right, Jeremy, thank you very much. Here's Derek in Plymouth. Derek, it's Peter and Jalene on WRIF. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how you doing today?
You're doing good.
Good.
What's up?
Hi.
How you were saying earlier that they're spending, you know, trillions of dollars on this war and all the stuff that...
Wars.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what's up?
Well, where's all this trillions of dollars going? I mean, we got hundreds and hundreds of American people who need jobs, and they're blowing money like no other.
Yeah, for wars that were based upon lies and
What are you saying? That that employs people?
Yeah, no, I'm saying it doesn't. It's just,
right.
Right. Well, I mean, it's not like nobody gets employed because within the military-industrial
complex. He's saying here, these people here in the United States need jobs.
Yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying, yeah.
Outside of the military.
Yeah. And, those could be like Roosevelt did during the 1930s. These huge, massive public works programs at union wages. Like, I don't know what your situation is, Derek, but I bet you if a lot of people who are unemployed now were offered, say, $18 to $20 an hour to do...
Bam!
Yeah, make this country a jewel of an infrastructure. I bet you get a lot of people to say, yeah, that's a good idea.
That would make 100% of a difference, I think. That would create a lot more income for everybody. More people could spend money, and it pumps more money back into the economy.
Bing! Yeah. You hit it right on it. Because here, again, I mean, I mentioned this last few weeks. These Republicans, they have this theory of what they call supply-side economics. And this is because they got to have some, they can't be, a spokesperson for the wealthy and just say, we want the wealthy to have more money, just because they want to have money. They got to have an excuse. And the deal is you cut their taxes, you cut regulations on their activities, and then they have more money, and then they invest it in businesses, and then more people are employed. Well, never has happened. It hasn't happened. You had the Bush tax cuts. There wasn't more revenue coming in. There was less. So it is exactly, Derek, what you hit it on. It's demand side economics. So that you put, like, rather than cutting Social Security, rather than some poor, lonely, elderly woman living in a house by herself trying to make it on $750 a month, if she was given, like, a $500 a month raise in her Social Security. Think of the words, too. We just think of it as, what it is. It gives us money. But it's social security.
Security.
It's security. You're not secure at $750 a month. If she had another $500, she'd be spending all that as well. So she would. You are absolutely correct. Thank you, Derek. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Actually, it looks like Jim from Westline, I'm get you right on, Jim, is going to talk about what we need to cut. So, let's talk about that. Other people have ideas of what to cut. Let me hear it. I'd just say,
sure.
The military.
Absolutely.
Hey, here's Jim in Westline. Jim, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing, Peter? How you guys doing?
We're doing.
It's not for me really exactly what we need to cut. It's just what really shouldn't we cut? We've really gone, like, over the past, I'd say, 100 years, our government has just grown so much, and the responsibilities upon everybody's lives have grown so much. You guys were talking about Social Security. Well, things like that weren't around for the first couple of 100 years of this country's existence, but we did okay.
No.
And people fought very, 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 very hard to get these rights.
People did not do okay. People did horribly. There was two classes in this country. There was the ultra-wealthy, and then there was the working...
Poverty.
Well, there was three. There was the ultra-wealthy, the ruling class, and the employers, the corporations, and all that, the company owners. And then there was a very, very, very small class of administrators. Then there was this huge working class, and then there was this mass of poor. The working class had no guarantees of anything. They had no health insurance. They had nothing when they retired.
Mortality rates were
low beyond belief. I mean, you can just look at the social indices go up. Beginning in the 1930s when finally these programs began to come into play. And look at some of these countries in Scandinavia and Britain and what have you that take care of their people. I mean, what the hell's the sense?
Let's not be too nice to Britain. Okay, well, Denmark.
Yeah. All right, Jim. Thank you very much. Do we have time? Let me see. What do we got for? Oh, I can't remember. I gotta look. Right. Give the phone number.
Okay, we have a whole another hour of the show, and 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. A few open lines, so start thinking about what you want to say, and just call away.
Yeah, and actually, my guest at 1 a.m. is going to hit it directly. Richard Heinberg, he's the guy that made famous the concept of peak oil, that we're going to start running out of oil if we haven't already. And he's written a new book called The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. And he's talking about, you know, we're not growing anywhere. And so the idea that we could have an ever-expanding economy that all of us would share in, it's gone. So what in its place is going to be this, essentially this system, what I've said before, like Guatemala, Mexico.
Corporations.
Yeah. Can we get one more? You know, why don't we do this? Kevin and Ron and Mike, hold on, and we'll get you on right after the break. Also, more calls.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
We're college roommates turned real-life roommates.
Peas in a pod.
And still BFFs.
We even got the same car insurance discounts from Esurance.
I got my discounts on their website.
But I got mine over the phone from this awesome Esurance agent.
Like, how awesome?
Like half as awesome as you.
Awesome.
For awesome car insurance discounts, get a quote today at Esurance.com or 1-800-ESURANCE. Esurance. Technology when you want it. People when you don't. Not available in all states. Some restrictions apply. Discounts may vary by state. See site for details.
Awesome.
Rates, policy forms, and availability vary by state. Did you know that life insurance rates are near record lows? If you own life insurance or are thinking of buying any, why spend more than you have to? I'm Byron Udell, founder of AccuQuote. Since 1986, we've helped hundreds of thousands of people just like you save a fortune on their life insurance. Here's how we do it. We monitor the products offered by dozens of the most well-respected brand-name life insurance companies you trust so that you get the lowest rates. For example, a healthy 40-year-old can buy $500,000 of 10-year level term for less than $21 a month. 20 and 30-year rates are also available. And don't forget to ask us about the new term life plans that guarantee your money back even if you don't die. Take 5 minutes and call AccuQuote for your free quote at 800-654-2075. Find out how much you can save on your life insurance. Call AccuQuote today at 800-654-2075. That's 800-654-2075.
Do you have a disability that prevents you from working? Then you may be entitled to collect thousands of dollars of Social Security benefits. If you've been medically disabled for at least 12 months and previously worked 5 of the last 10 years, you may qualify to receive thousands of dollars paid directly to you every month. Just call Disability Benefits Alliance at 1-877-941-8822. Disability Benefits Alliance can cut through government red tape and help you receive Social Security disability.
This is your Travel Minute. If you're planning a flight for business or pleasure anytime soon, here's the 3-1-1 rule for carry-on luggage to ease your way through airport security lines. Rule 1. Only 3-ounce or smaller containers of liquid or gel are permitted in carry-on luggage. However, larger containers are permitted in your check-in baggage. 2. Place your 3-ounce or smaller containers into one 1-quart size clear plastic zip-top bag. Only one bag per traveler is allowed. 3. Place the bag into the security bin with your shoes and other items as required for scanning. The rules for other personal items vary, so it's a good idea to check with your airline or travel agent before you pack for your trip.
Your Travel Minute is a public service by this station and ASTA, the American Society of Travel Agents.
My dad is my hero. He goes into burning buildings. He finds people inside who need to be saved. He helps them get out. Even when he can't breathe or see or is a little scared. My dad is a firefighter, but the best thing he can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration reminds you to protect yourself and firefighters. Have smoke alarms on every level and near sleeping areas. Test them monthly. Change batteries as instructed. Install sprinklers. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, most fire deaths occur in homes with no working smoke alarms. The good news is, that's a fact we can change. Smoke alarms save lives. Find out more at usfa.dhs.gov.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Everything that rocks. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. According to Associated Press, President Barack Obama and the Republicans sealed a deal Sunday. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you can call that a deal. It's a deal for the Republicans. It's a deal for the ultra-wealthy to avoid the nation's first financial default and raise the debt limit while slashing more than $2 trillion from federal spending over a decade. Now, here's the problem. This could mean wide-ranging cuts in federal aid to states affecting everything from Head Start, school readiness programs, Meals on Wheels, and worker training initiatives to funding for transit agencies and education grants that serve disabled children. This is the Republican mentality at work, and why in the world Barack Obama and some of the Republicans are going to buy into it is way beyond me. Can we get Bernie Sanders to be president of the United States? If you don't know who Bernie Sanders is, just Google this man, and that'll tell you all about it. Here's another thing. It gives you an idea also when you talk about what do you want to cut. The governor of the state of Florida, Rick Scott, not to be confused with
Speaking
Rick Snyder
of nutbags.
Yeah, who was this? Now I can't remember. I don't have this at my fingertips. But he was involved in some financial scams. He was head of a private health care firm, made hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, and he says, well, we're not going to take any money from this new health plan that the Congress passed, the Affordable Care Act. Imagine that, the Affordable Care Act. Naturally, he's against that.
But sure.
Here's what they have turned down. This is money that would sign up eligible recipients for Medicare. A lot of elderly people don't even understand this. So this would be a program to say, hey, look, you can get in on this.
This is how it works, and this is how we want to help you.
Yeah, educate teenagers on preventing pregnancy.
Huh. Which is a good idea.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, yeah, here is rejected grants aimed at moving long-term care patients into their home, curbing child abuse through in-home counseling, and strengthening state regulations of health premiums.
I mean, how dare they want to have any of these things? How dare we have anything positive?
Yeah. Here is another thing, too. And, there's a recommendation. The leading medical advisory panel recommended on Tuesday that all insurers be required to cover contraceptives for women free of charge as one of several preventive services under the new health care law, mm-hmm. the Affordable Care. So you go, well, wait a minute. What are you, giving people? The Catholic Church raised strenuous objection.
Just get out of my uterus already.
Yeah.
Get out of it.
But here, this was interesting that I saw this letter. What did it say? It is obvious that given the appalling reality, this is a letter to the New York Times, given the appalling reality that half of all pregnancies in this country are unintended. Can you imagine that?
Really?
It is obvious that lack of information, and I would say access.
Like, how can people not have information?
Well, they don't have access.
You know, this plus this equals baby.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, no, about birth control options. Maybe
I know. It's sad.
As well as lack of financial resources account for too many pregnancies and unavoidable pressures to end them. So perhaps the women's movement should give a higher priority to ensuring education about and access to birth control than to abortion rights, which might accomplish more for women.
And believe me, the women's movement is on this. It's on it.
Okay.
Yes. It's that they're unheard. No one, there's so many men at that level who just don't care. They want to control our bodies, but they don't care about what we think about our own bodies.
Yeah. And then you have all these men that are lined up to end a woman's right to abortion.
Yeah.
Yeah. So here's what you could do. Free contraceptives as part of the Affordable Care Act,
and that
which would significantly cut down on abortions.
Yeah.
So you all about that?
Isn't it kind of common sense? These people are idiots.
313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Here is Ron. Ron, you're on the air. Where are you calling from?
Oh, Westland.
Go ahead.
Hi,
you're
Ron.
On the air.
Hi. Yeah, it's been a while since I've heard your show. So, anyways, good to hear you. You know, anyways.
Still raving?
Thank you.
I caught a little bit about the comments about the U.S. empire and how, you know, the military spending and all that. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to share with your listeners the concept or idea, and it's an anthropological term, and I don't want to sound all academically snooty here because it's basically common sense. But if any of your listeners are kind of doubting the effects of what happens to a nation state when they just try to get too big, there's something called a core periphery theory of state level development. And it's just as it sounds. You have a core and then you have a periphery.
Yeah.
And your periphery obviously is all your outlying areas. And the concept basically boils down to simply this. The more successful you get, or the bigger and the stronger you get, the harder it gets to maintain your success. So it gets to a point of diminished returns, and I think that's what our country is at right now. It's like we're all over the place, and we're kind of crumbling over here. And I completely agree with the military spending. That needs to be cut. And you know, regardless of what political party you belong to or what your social values are or your whatever your background is, this is something that has played out time and time again. It's basically, you know, in certain aspects, it's considered common knowledge or understood to be true. So anyways, for your listeners, look up core periphery theory of state-level development.
Slow down. Just
well,
kidding.
Actually, you know what we are? We're big enough to fail. I mean, and that's been the nature of, I mean, you know, there's Jared Diamond has an incredible book called Collapse, which is so frightening to read that I don't even know if I'd recommend it. But, yeah, I mean, what's the old phrase? Too big for your britches. You know, there were these imperialists, different periods in American history that wanted to annex Mexico, wanted to annex Central America, wanted to annex Cuba. You know, they wanted to just keep expanding the size of this country, which was not a good idea. All right, thank you very much. Thanks for the tip on that. Our next caller is, I'm looking just in terms of who's been waiting the longest. Here's Mike in Clyde Township. Mike, hi, it's Peter and Jalene on WRIF. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Sure.
Hey, you was talking about that class warfare earlier, but don't you have to have two sides with that? I think both sides haven't figured out that there's anything going on.
Well, I know. I mean, we all know that something's going on. You know, they do, if you say to the American people, I was talking about this last week, in order to solve the debt problem, do you, not you, but, you know, they asked people this, do you support raising taxes? Only 33% of the people said yes, they did. Then you ask them, how about this? Do you support raising the taxes on people making over $250,000 a year? And 78% of the people said yes.
Right. And the other thing I don't understand why people can't see when they keep saying if you cut taxes, give the wealthy more. If you look, I don't know if the percentage is exactly right, but my understanding from 10 years ago, the top 3% controlled like 11% of the income or the money, and it went up to 17. So they've got more money, but yet the unemployment went up. So how is it logical to give them more money to get jobs when you've given them more money and the unemployment went up?
Yeah, you're right. And actually, you know, you remind me of me. You know these, you saw these figures at one time. You don't remember them exactly, but it's much greater than that. I mean, the amount of wealth controlled by the upper, the ultra wealthy are,
I mean, it's almost all of it.
Yeah, really. It's expanding. I mean, there was an expansion in productivity over the last 30 years. And the middle class, who would usually share in it, sometimes the working class does, shared in it like next to nothing. And all of it went to the high side. So it's, you know, if it worked, what's the old thing? There was a book one time called Everything I Know I Learned in Kindergarten, wasn't that it?
All I Need to Know or something like that.
Yeah, and the thing was, you know, don't bring candy to class unless you have something to share with everyone.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we're not talking about some absolutely communist socialist thing where everybody makes the same wage. But under a capitalism, that cared about its citizenry, that wasn't based in war and empire, that we wouldn't let schools go into default. We wouldn't let millions of people be on the verge of losing their homes. We wouldn't have millions of people unemployed. We wouldn't have these endless wars. It takes, two to fight. And right now, it's, I don't know what you'd call it. It's not class warfare. I guess it's just class domination. I mean, we're just, I used to say all the time, either we got to fight back or just agree we're peasants and thatch our roofs. And I guess that's where we're at. All right, Mike, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot. Just for your information, they do have a petition out there to put the financial manager on the ballot.
Oh, the bill. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think, all right, thank you very much. I think that emergency financial manager bill that would allow the governor just to, like, take over cities, abrogate union contracts the way his emergency financial manager just did for the Detroit school teachers. Wait, you're not going to do it. You have a contract. You can't just go. I mean, I can't imagine that even a conservative judge would say, contract? What the hell? That doesn't mean anything.
Right.
I mean, isn't that what they're all about?
Anyway, right?
Yeah. All right. Here is Roger in St. Clair Shores. Hi, Roger. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing tonight, Peter?
We're good.
Good. Hey, I got a couple things to say. I'm a fan of your show, only because I kind of laugh at what some of the things you're saying. And no offense, no disrespect.
Well, I mean, we try to get laughs out of people.
No offense.
I'm sure you're only laughing at the things we intend for humor.
Yes.
Go ahead. Well, go ahead.
But one of the things that most important is you said earlier in the show we spend more than 10 of the top militaries in the rest of the world. I forget how you worded it.
That was actually Bill Maher that said that, but yeah.
Oh, okay, you must have been quoting him. Okay, I don't know that to be true. I was just wondering if you guys know how much China spends a year on their military.
Well, it's, do I have the figures, you mean?
Well, I mean...
It's significantly, China is included in that. The United States spends more, at least, I can't remember it all, but at least more than the 10 other top military expenditures of countries in the world. That wasn't a very elegant sentence, but I think you got it. In other words, if you add up what China spends, what Russia spends, what Britain spends, what France spends, it doesn't even, and 6 or 8 more countries, it doesn't even add up to what we spend.
Do you really believe that's true?
What do you mean, do I really believe it's true?
It is true.
I mean, you think that that somebody, like, they're hiding?
Well, you might need to look that up, because China is unleashing, from what I've heard, is a 50 million man Navy. Now, how can you fund that?
What?
Wait. Let me guess where you're getting this. Fox News?
I get it from, I listen to all the news. I listen to you, listen to Fox.
Where did you get this one?
I can't remember.
Well, here, I can't remember.
You need to cite your sources,
yeah,
because that's a ridiculous number.
That is a ridiculous number. But here, one of the 50 million.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, what if they got to have a lot of boats?
Yeah.
They have a lot of boats.
Is
but
there
here,
even enough water?
Here's what I said, Roger. What would be the disadvantage to the United States to say to China, listen, we're just wasting our money on this empire of ours and these outrageous sums that we, the United States, are spending on our military. I mean, we've got the fleet all over Asia. They don't have any fleet around our country. I mean, we'd be a little PO'd if they had boats off. If they were doing, say the Chinese were doing military exercises of a major nature with Cuba, do you think we'd be a little pissed off?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, yeah. Well, right now, the United States may have even occurred. We're doing major military exercises with Vietnam, which has always been hostile to China. And so rather than doing stuff like that, what if we said, you know what? We don't want to keep spending all this money. We would rather take this money and spend it on our schools and our roads and everything else that would make our country nice. Yeah. And why don't we, the United States and China, sign a non-aggression and disarmament pact so that we'll agree to take all of our, we'll stop defending Taiwan will stop. Well, I mean, that, maybe that's a little too tricky. Let me take that off the board. But we will stop sending our ships all over your area of the world, and we'll cut back on the kind of armaments we have. Let's begin a nuclear disarmament treaty that will get Russia and everybody else, you know, maybe even Israel in on it and all that. What would be the harm of attempting to have a worldwide peace treaty?
I would agree with that 100%. And I agree with almost everything you're saying.
Yeah, but
except for the fact that ain't really going to happen, and you know that.
Well,
you were in the arms race with Russia for.
Well, it's not going to happen because there's an institutional investment in it by all sorts of political and financial forces, and it becomes the nature of the culture of a particular nation state. And it certainly was in the Soviet Union, and it certainly was here. I mean, the Cold War served lots of purposes beyond allegedly defending us from communism. I mean, it had a lot of domestic implications as well. I mean, one of the things that it did, of course, was to oppose any sort of native radicalism here in this country, or you know, or strong labor presence. But all right, let's leave it at that. Appreciate your call. Thank you. So,
and we'll keep trying to be funny.
Yeah. So what's wrong with that? Why don't we have, rather than always preparing for war, why don't we say, well, I mean, what would, you know, you say, you know, can't trust Chinese. Here's probably the people we've been taught you could trust least, and that would be the Iranians. Say to the Iranians, hey, you know, look, we don't want to have to keep building all this missile stuff in China. Where is it now? Czechoslovakia and Poland, all, which is absolutely insane. You know, millions and hundreds of millions of dollars, probably billions are being spent of our tax dollars to build anti-nuclear missile facilities in Europe against Iranian missiles. I mean, for one thing, why are we protecting, if that's an issue, which it's not, it's an absolute fabrication, why are we footing the bill to protect Poland and Czechoslovakia?
Mm-hmm.
Do you really think anybody in Poland or Czechoslovakia is worried that Iran is going to nuke them?
I don't think so.
And if they would, the only reason that they would is because they're tied in with us, but they're
and
not going
to
do
about
it.
What all of that is doing to our relationship with Russia.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
And let's also talk about that little thing that we have going, that little debt thing going with China.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Little big.
You know, one of the things, and I even forgot about a couple things, just about this whole debt ceiling crisis. This has been this limited conversation on the media, as it always is, between Tweedledee and Tweedledummer.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about us.
No. And the idea that you would bring in people from the multitude of people that opposed any sort of cutbacks in spending for social programs and demanding a reduction in the military, you know, a callback of the empire, and most importantly, taxing the wealthy and the corporations so you don't have companies not paying any taxes whatsoever. Those voices were totally missing from the debate. Unless you went on certain websites, did you ever find a senator of the United States, Bernie Sanders, an independent, not a Democrat, not a Republican, from Vermont? Did you ever hear what he had to say? They wouldn't let him on.
That's right. You have to really search to find him.
And all the progressives, all the left liberals, absolutely excluded from it. So
he has a really great website. Just Google Bernie Sanders, and he's got some good web presence, and you can follow what he's saying.
Draft,
I recommend.
Draft Bernie for president.
Yeah.
Here's Gary in Romulus. Gary, hi. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Gary.
Peter and Jalene.
You know, I think some of our callers, they need some type of history lesson. The one individual said how things were great in the United States before we had social programs.
Right. Wow.
Why did they need them?
You know,
why did they need or want them then if life was great?
You know, we're getting history lessons from Sarah Palin.
Yeah, it seems like it, doesn't it?
And all that stuff's accessible, like the bonus march where, you know, during Hoover where we attacked our own soldiers.
Well, okay, they're coming to get you, Gary.
They know you're listening.
Yep. But, about the bonus march during Hoover.
Big march on Washington in either 1931 or 1932, right?
Yeah. And you know, you look back, my great-grandmother, she settled in St. Clair Shores from France. And she had a story about how they had to sell their farm off piecemeal. And the big myth is where, you know, there was plenty of money in the United States at the time of the Depression. It's just only certain people had it.
Yeah, sure.
And it was so. I use the term diabolical. She said that she'd sell off to pay taxes, food, and so on and so forth. Individuals come in with a briefcase, and she was a little girl at the time, and she'd see, you know, things change hands, and the question was, well, why didn't you try to get a better deal? And there was a system set up where it didn't matter. And that's how the term diabolical it was.
Yeah, well, you know, when you go back just a minute for the bonus march, which was in, I don't have it in front of me, but in the early 30s before Roosevelt became president, and these unemployed World War I veterans came to Washington, D.C. in the middle of some hot month and set up these encampments.
Yeah, this was something else, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then they sent the army after them. And burned their camp, injured people,
yeah.
Led by General Douglas MacArthur and Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Oh, my.
A shameful little episode in American history. All right, Gary, thank you for your opinions. Appreciate it. Here is Ken in Flat Rock. Ken, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Well, hello, Peter. How are you doing?
We're good.
I'm going to try to be civil. You know, I got on the website for your guys' show and...
Great.
No insults, please. And, geez, man, you guys have been insulting the hell out of me all night. And,
oh, don't take it personally.
I just wanted to get one mark in there for the Tea Party movement.
Yeah.
Oh.
I'm not Republican or Democrat. You know, I consider myself independent, but I am conservative, and I really believe in the Constitution.
Yeah.
And
oh, boy.
Well, so do we. I have
one. We do too. What makes people think that we don't? Tell me that.
How close is the nearest constitution to you? Physically.
Inside the house. I'm outside my garage.
Okay. Well, I got one right in my hand.
Right here.
So anyway, what? Give me the headlines here. What's up?
Well, I believe that the founding fathers. Really had a vested interest off of them, and they were deeply divided when they made the Constitution, but their biggest concern was not having a centralized government that had the power that our government does right now, that the states should control their own destiny.
Oh, boy.
So what do you think?
We're going to go back to the days of racism. Oh, gosh, that sounds
great. So you think
states
ought to be allowed to segregate the races?
Not up in the original Constitution Convention. I mean, that almost divided them through. And that was something that they kicked the can down. They originally started kicking the can down, and racism was the first subject matter they did it with.
Well, sure. The only reason those southern colonies wanted to separate from England is because they were fearful that the British government was going to...
take away their help.
We're going to take away slavery, and as colonies, they would do it. And so Jefferson, and people like that who had... decent impulses about things like slavery, wanted to end slavery. He and the others, they had to compromise with these slaveholders. I mean, I don't know what they got out of it was the United States, but it's a pretty decent foundation document. But slavery appears in the affirmation of slavery and the slave trade and what have you is pretty heavily represented in there. But anyway, things change over the years. So, I mean, and you have states' rights. Well, you could have states that say, we abolish abortion completely, or we want to have segregation, or we're not going to allow Jews into our medical schools, or, you know, we don't want any safety regulations in our state. Or we could have prohibition of liquor in our state. Maybe even could now. I don't know. But the rest of them. I mean, that's why the states proved absolutely inadequate to the task of modern society.
I don't believe that, though.
So what do you want to do? Give me. That's what I mean. The headline.
Well, I'm not saying our history is full of ugliness. I'll give everybody that. But that's how you weed it out. Who's going to be the most successful?
Weed what out? People?
No, ideas.
Maybe we could get you a time machine, because it seems like you'd be happier back then.
Well, here, but let me ask you this, Ken. What would you like to see? What would you like to see different? I mean, no Social Security?
Well, I mean, I can't turn the clock back on that.
Oh, sorry. You're about, how about Medicare?
Absolutely.
Get rid of Medicare?
I thought you said Obamacare.
No, Medicare.
What about the people, the elderly?
Well, here's what Bill Maher said. I don't know if you heard that earlier, but he said when you ask who he called, you don't like to be called that, teabaggers, which originally they were, they called themselves. Yeah, until they learned what it meant. When you say, okay, we want these big cuts. And then when you say, well, what do you want to cut? And they don't come up with any. NPR. That's what they say.
Yeah, and Planned Parenthood.
And Planned Parenthood, which is probably about 0.1%. The big ticket items is the military and the entitlement programs, right?
Well, let's cut the military.
Okay.
Bring it. Hey.
All right.
Woo! Yeah.
No, I'll grant you that.
Bring it on.
So we're not insulting you there, huh? We haven't been insulting you on that level.
No.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
But you have to understand that our military has been protecting half the world, for the last 50, 60, 70 years.
Like
World War II.
Like, name a couple instances.
Germany. Most of Europe, for instance. I mean, we probably have about 35% of our troops in Europe right now.
You really think that the Soviet Union would have invaded Western Europe?
Why wouldn't they give up any of the countries they had? For instance, East Germany after World War II.
Well, they suffered. Listen, I don't want to start defending some authoritarian police state like Stalinist Russia, but there was this war fought, which the main intent was to destroy the Soviet Union. That was the big goal of the Nazi war machine. The Nazis were defeated essentially by the Red Army and had casualties among their population up to 30 million, and what they did, they moved into these countries that had been allied with the Nazis, not entirely, but Germany and Hungary and places like that, and they wanted essentially reparations. They also wanted a buffer between the West because they were fearful of the West was going to invade them, and in fact there were contingency plans to do just that. There was never. I mean, they've opened up the Soviet archives. There was never any intention of going further than the line that they already had. But there was always the debate within Western military circles is how can they reclaim this land that was taken out of world capitalism? It's back in now, though, so everything worked out.
Let me ask you, I mean, there was a Cold War.
Yeah.
In nearly every war, there's a winner and there's a loser.
Yeah.
Who won the Cold War?
Well, I don't know. Who won the Cold War? I mean, I guess it's the Soviet Union and their brand of capitalism or state capitalism collapsed, what they called communism. We won. In the meantime, though, we created this enormous military-industrial complex that you said you'd like to
do away with. Cut back
and
on.
This huge debt was created because of military expenditures by Ronald Reagan. I mean, the country got in serious debt during his administration. All right, I got to move on.
And people give him all that credit.
Yeah. I don't know for what.
I don't either.
One of the worst presidents
ever.
Here's Russ in Clarkston. Russ, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. Just leaving the concert, and I tuned in a little bit. And I did call in first about the abortion versus the national health care issue. And I do want to touch on that. But did I misunderstand some comments that you're giving Bill Maher more credence or credibility than Fox News, or did I misunderstand?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would. 100%.
100%.
Yeah, why? You don't?
Oh, okay. I guess that kind of took me back a little bit that Bill Maher and his comedic history and his obvious blindness of reality. I guess I'm just shocked that people would give Bill Maher and the things that he says.
Well, I just listen.
Fox News is just right up there. You know, I mean, come on. What are these? These are a bunch of bimbos telling you a bunch of lies.
Yeah, I would say that Fox News, I mean, they've done these studies. The more you watch Fox News, the less you know. I would say, I mean, I played that clip by Bill Maher because I thought that he had presented the situation with the debt and what's causing it and what has to be done in a way that was also comedic. If I was just to put on, I don't know, like some NPR commentator, people would probably go to sleep and turn off.
what I don't understand is, okay, so we have Fox News. We all know where they fall on the spectrum,
right,
of, you know, conservative versus the, okay, we know that, right?
Right, right.
But we have Fox News, and we compare that to NBC, CBS, ABC, CNN, MSNBC, and the list goes on and on with the other stations who they themselves know exactly, and we know where they fall. So, I mean,
where do they fall?
Where? Because they're journalists, right? So they,
well, they are in the business of creating news, not reporting the news.
And how does NBC do that? I mean, NBC,
they report the news.
Yeah, I would say that if anything, if they have any politics, I mean, it's this corporate news outlet that doesn't appear to have an agenda.
It's not like Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah.
Oh, well, see, but boy, I knew you were going to be bringing up Rupert Murdoch. But let me ask you, how many commentators on Fox News has been dismissed, like a Keith Olbermann or like the Dan Rather?
Well, why would they be? Because they're toting the owner's entire political row. I mean,
all of those guys spew out this unending stream of mis and disinformation, catered to the worst aspects of American population.
But damn, they look good, Pierre.
Yeah, they. I don't know. I can't. I gotta take a break.
Let's not. It's futile.
Yeah, futile. See you, Russ.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
What do you see yourself doing a few years from now? Thinking about a career is one thing, but preparing for a career is what really counts. If an education in information technology, electronics technology, or drafting and design could help you prepare, then check out the technology-focused programs offered at ITT Technical Institute. Call ITT Tech at 800-741-5123. At ITT Tech, you can develop knowledge and skills to pursue opportunities in a variety of career fields. Classes and day or evening courses meet just a few days a week, and financial aid's available for those who qualify. So if you want to prepare for a career involving technology, look to a leader in technology education. Get started by calling ITT Tech for more information. Call 800-741-5123. 800-741-5123. That's ITT Tech. 800-741-5123. For important information about these programs, go to programinfo.itt-tech.edu.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Wow, that was a short break, wasn't it?
Yes.
We're back.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, in about half an hour, I'm going to be interviewing Richard Hindberg. Richard Hindberg, famous for his theory of peak oil. A lot of times, if you haven't heard this stuff before and you're interested, just go Google it. Hindberg, H-E-I-N-B-E-R-G, or richardhindberg.com.
And watch your sources as you Google.
Yeah. And, go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com. We haven't looked in on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/nightcall.
Mm-hmm.
And people talking about this stuff. Friends always wanted. Please join us there. Let's go back. The guy was actually defending Fox News.
Oh, it happens.
I mean, they have a listenership. Sadly. You know, one of the things is that liberals get all exercised about Fox News and Bill O'Reilly and Hannity and the rest of them. You know, they got about 1 million listeners. That's a lot. But you know what? It's a pretty small world of which all of that circulates, and including mm-hmm. all the MSNBC stuff with Rachel Maddow and Ed Schultz.
Ed Schultz.
I love those guys.
Mm-hmm.
But
I don't watch any of it. It's all crap. No, I know. I really like Ed Schultz and I like Rachel Maddow, but you've been watching too much of it lately.
I haven't stopped.
I really think.
I'm back to watching.
Oh, please. Where's my Peter?
Wait a minute. Here's, I don't know. Let's give this guy a shot. Here's Craig, Craig in Flat Rock. Our last caller didn't like Bill Maher. What do you think, Craig?
Oh, I'm a big Bill Maher fan. I mean, I think he's great. He made a comment on, I'm not sure if it was Friday's episode or the week before, because I just DVR'd them and watched them both last night. But he made a comment about the two parties. He said one party has no brains and the other party has no balls. And he couldn't have been more spot on.
Yes,
I think that was Friday
really
night.
Good.
I actually saw that on Friday. Why was I at home on Friday night? I don't know.
Must have been a replay.
Yeah. No. I was there at 11 o'clock. You say, I'm out. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah, right. No. Bill Maher, yeah, is good. Is the only place you can see him on is on HBO?
Yes.
Yeah, that's all I ever see him on.
Yeah, because I'm surprised, I guess it's a premium channel. It's the only thing we have that's premium. And when my wife called and we said, we're canceling our Comcast, and they said, let us, can you do that?
You're giving people ideas now.
Yeah, we should.
Your wife's pretty convincing, though.
When your contract's about to expire, just say you're canceling and going with whoever else is available, and they'll give you lots of stuff.
If you're lucky.
Thanks, Craig. Appreciate that. I mean, that made me think, Friday night. Who did I see? Melvin Davis. He is an old R&B Motown kind of guy. He was a drummer for Marvin Gaye for 3.5 years.
Oh, cool.
And these things, I don't even know if I should tell people about this stuff at the Detroit Institute of Arts. I mean, the fabulous
Friday
music
night
they
music,
have down
yeah.
there. All this music they have. I mean, they have everything from classical to rock and roll and stuff like this. And this Melvin Davis and the United Sounds. United Sounds, famous recording studio where so much of this stuff, George Clinton, people like that. But this guy was totally old school, complete white suit with a black shirt and a black vest on.
Very nice.
Black and white shoes and talking about Detroit.
That's great.
Yeah.
Love it.
It was great. So, but my wife, everybody's getting this damn cold.
It's not good.
So I actually went without her, saw it, came right home. That's why I was home by 11.
Bill Maher.
Yeah. All right. Hey, some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Here is Stephen in Pontiac. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. I was calling to talk about some local issues, but I kind of want to comment on the Fox News debate since that's been brought up.
Sure, but do tell. I want to hear about the local stuff too. Yeah. But give me a one or two liner about Fox News.
All right, well...
But now, all of a sudden, everybody wants to talk about Fox
go
News.
Go for it.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
I went on the local news first.
Yeah.
And I was just going to say that it's technically Monday morning, which means that the Oakland County Sheriff's Department has officially replaced the Pontiac City Police.
That's right. They're gone. Oh, boy.
So everyone in Oakland County, vote out Bouchard. We don't need him.
Okay. And what about Fox News?
About the Fox News thing, really, like, I agree with you guys 100%. This Fox News is nothing but disinformation propaganda spewed out by Murdoch and his Australian dollars. But I've been listening to your show tonight, and you guys have been really, really vilifying not only the listeners of Fox News and the Tea Party, but all kinds of conservative people, and you're not making any fans tonight. I understand you guys are trying to get across your opinion, and it's very frustrating to me also, but this divisiveness is exactly what it's intended for, to keep people down and out, to keep...
Well, but here...
I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to pussyfoot around these issues to anyone. So for you to suggest that, while I want to be sensitive to your feelings, this is a political talk show.
He agrees with us.
Yeah,
he's talking,
I know.
But he doesn't want to...
So I don't care who it is. I'm not going to, like I said, pussyfoot around and go, you're right. Yeah. You know, this is exactly how we feel, and we feel it very strongly, and that's what this show has been doing for 40 years.
Yeah, Jim Hightower, who used to be the...
Sorry to be so fired up.
Yeah, Jim Hightower, who was the commissioner of agriculture for Texas for years, and now he's...
We're not talking about Hightower, the DJ.
No. Yeah. So Jim Hightower, if you go to
cool
JimHightower.com, he's got a book out, said... The only thing in the middle of the road is yellow lines and
dead chickens
armadillos.
Or something. Hell yeah, armadillos. Oh, they didn't get to the other
All
side.
Right. Thanks a lot. Now, I don't know what the hell. You know, we get so many, and I appreciate these people, and I would like you to do this. Jerry wrote in, please turn up the callers a bit. There are about 80% volume of you and Jolene. It is rough with my crappy laptop.
Well, here's the thing.
What?
Your laptop's crappy.
Yeah.
Sorry,
Someone
Jerry.
Wrote in. Yeah, I mean, I would rather, whenever there's a complaint about anything having to do
we
with...
We have everything checked out.
Yeah, we check it out. Because someone wrote, I think I might have deleted it, but they said that on the podcast that the callers were so low. So I went and listened to it, and it seemed perfect. I don't know what to do.
Like you said, try Mozilla because you seem to get good audio results from listening back. Try maybe a different, internet service.
Here's Brian from Ypsilanti. He's been waiting a long time. Brian, welcome, and thank you for being so patient.
Oh, thanks. I guess I just want to comment. It seems like every week you guys are against the rich, but I think, if anything, you should be respecting the rich. If you look at the people that have the most money, I'd say they're probably very intelligent. And I mean, if you take
I'm definitely going to, because someone's intelligence, I'm definitely going to respect them. Please, these people are freaking crooks. They are taking the people's money, and they don't even care. They don't care about you. We're talking about the corporations. We're talking about the billionaire CEOs, the corporations. We're not talking about like your mom or your dad or your Uncle Joe who owns their own business. We're talking about the crooks.
People say Bill Gates. Say you start the company.
Bill Gates is pretty good when it comes to these types of things.
There's other people like him. He starts a company. People want his product. They pay money for that product.
Yeah.
Say he's a billionaire. He actually is doing great things, right? He's doing more than the World Health Organization as far as combating disease in different companies.
Name more than him. Give me one. Well, one more billionaire who's doing good things besides his dad.
He was sending out, like, I forget, inoculations for some disease.
That's him. Fine. Name another one.
All right. How about this? The mayor of New York.
He finally did something.
How about...
give me one more.
The Koch brothers, David Koch.
Oh, my God, Peter.
I mean, he funds the teabaggers.
Yeah. Oh,
but
boy.
But he also gave all the money for the...
Well, he's got to cover up for his sliminess, Peter.
Listen, so many of these people, like, of the...
Do not kowtow to these
people.
I'm only
kidding.
I'm talking to this guy.
The 10...
Not you, Peter. I'm not yelling at you.
The 10 richest people in the... the 10 richest people in the United States, four or five of them, it's just inherited. Stephen Bechtel Jr., worth $3 billion, got rich by inheriting his money from his father. DeVos, run by his son, inherited. It just goes
Amway.
On.
Amway.
Yeah.
But they changed the name of that to make it sound a little less slimy.
Stanley Hubbard, $2 billion, inherited his wealth. The Koch brothers themselves, David Koch worth $22 billion and his brother worth about that much, they essentially inherited their money.
But they're intelligent, Peter. We need to be nice to them.
Hey, where do you cap it then? Like, say I work at a company and I make $2 million a year. Is that too much money?
Well,
we're not talking about you personally as a worker for a company. Are you not listening?
Here, listen. Are you making too much money? Well, you're making a large taxable amount of money. That in other countries that work a lot better than this one, that have full medical care for everybody, that workers are guaranteed 6 weeks off a year, that men and women get child leave when they have kids born and all of that. They don't have this because they don't have this 1% of the population that owns, this extraordinary amount. I mean, one of the things, what would be wrong with somebody that is making $2 million a year income, paying 50% income tax in a period where we need revenue?
Well, because say that person wants to go and they want to race a car, and it costs them $300,000 a year to do that. Now, should they be denied doing that? Because
you know what? As opposed to denying
boys with toys comes first.
Yeah, I mean, this is the rich love you. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
just keep it up,
Brian,
because
they
all you're doing is sniffing their butts, and they don't care.
Goodbye. we to get to more callers, but there's also some open lines. 313-298-WRIF.
And only about 15 minutes left of the show.
Do you realize that these rich people don't care anything about you?
At all.
That they think you're fit to serve their food and to do
kiss
all
their feet.
Yeah, and defending them. I mean, come
they love
on.
You. They love you.
Here's Jerry in St. Clair Shores. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just got a couple quick comments. The first is about the media. You know, I don't know why these people think that Fox News, CNN, MSNBC, the people who brought you the slam dunk, smoking gun, mushroom clouds of weapons of mass destruction, are somehow upstanding pillars of more journalistic integrity. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, in that instance, they went right along with old Bushy, and
that's just insane that people could think that. The other thing about, you know, this whole people supporting the rich and everything like that, you know, we tell the people who have no power, no authority, no resources, it's all about the choices they make, as if you have that many choices. Well, how does this sound as fair? To whom much is given, much will be expected, or to put another way, each according to his ability. But yet the rich have abdicated their responsibilities toward this country, and they've sold us down the river.
Sure. You know what? Let me tell you something. The caller before
Amen,
you,
brother.
The caller before you mentioned Bill Gates. Bill Gates' father, who, you know, he didn't start off like some poverty-stricken kid. He,
right.
His father was this wealthy attorney in Seattle. And his father, though, works with this organization called Responsible Wealth, which advocates for higher taxes on the wealthy. And every time Bill Gates Sr. gets some tax break, like for Bush, he takes the amount of money, and he's got, you know, tens of millions of dollars. I think his son is giving him some stuff. He takes the millions of dollars that he gets because of these tax breaks for the rich, and he donates it to socially conscious groups. So a guy like him thinks, you know, so there are some wealthy that in groups like Responsible Wealth that realize that their position doesn't necessitate them having to claw to their
breast. Does it necessitate greed, Peter?
Yeah, so they can spend $300,000
on the waste car.
Yeah, I mean, how can you live with yourself when you're doing that? When other people in this country, when there's literally millions of people in this country that are in danger of hunger every single day,
dying from starvation in the United States of America. I'm sure it happens.
They're not dying.
Some people.
They're at risk.
Yes.
Yes. All right. Okay. Thank you. You are on such a roll tonight. Well, you know what? But poor nutrition by poor people
in the end
does
lead poor healthcare
to death. Yeah, absolutely, for sure.
I knew you'd come around to my way of thinking.
Indeed. Here's Ken in Detroit. Ken, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just calling to spread some positive news that there are some Republicans out there that are getting smart, and they're actually signing a petition for. I believe it's firerickschneider.org.
Oh, recall Rick.
Right. And there's I don't want to give any specifics, but there's a county in the Metro Detroit area that's had a sheriff there that's been, he's running, is always advertised as a Republican. And he spread the word to the department that this petition was available, but not to sign during, you know, duty
business
hours. And I'm a witness. The police were coming up and asking me where the petition was to sign it.
Really?
Wow. And the sheriff said, he said, where have you been? You know, I've been looking for this petition. You know,
well, they should be because Rick wants to knock them down too.
Cutbacks, yeah.
Their wet dream is to privatize everything.
Sure.
Absolutely.
So the police won't be. You know, the city of so-and-so police, it would be Blackwater police.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
And it will not be unionized police.
Right, exactly. Yeah. They would fire all the police and then say, do you want your job back? Fire department, everything. You know, and the guys at the, you know, if you want your job back, you'll take it for $4 an hour or whatever, you know, whatever non-union rate, you know. At, you know, and then you'd have no rights there, even as a police officer. And then it would, like I said, it'd be Blackwater contracting.
You know,
and even the guys at the jail too, they were all signing. But
good.
I was just going to say that sheriff did take some guff because the Republican's representative and the senator, or at least I know the representative did call him up and said, "What are you doing there, signing that petition?"
I'm sure they did call him up, but good for him for doing something like that.
There are some smart Republicans out there. So if you're listening,
yay!
All right, yeah.
Reason to celebrate.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Yeah, you can go to, I think it's, what did you
say? There's like a, just search Recall Rick.
Yeah.
You're going to find them all.
The petition is on my website as well, PeterWerbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. By the way, one of the things I forgot, in the race to the bottom that's being engineered by these Republicans that want to, as our last caller said, privatize everything, which would mean, of course, increasingly lower wages. The post office has just announced they're going to get rid of 3,600 post offices around the country.
Yeah.
Near us, the Ferndale post office, the Pleasant Ridge post office is already closed.
Really?
And I can't find this. I mean, there's two things that are happening here. Let me just deal with one of them. And that is that that they said, well, what about nearly 4,000 post offices might close. But this does not, you know, I couldn't find this in my stack. Thank you. They say it doesn't. The post office isn't operating at a profit, $8 billion loss. Well, how much, I always say, I mean, what are the fire, how much did the fire department lose? Fire department doesn't make any money.
Yes, right. They're actually just putting out fires.
Yeah,
well, not
yeah.
just, sorry.
But, what they're talking about doing, people are saying, well, where am I going to get postal services? They say, well, they'll have them in like Kroger's and Rite Aid
Wally World.
Yeah, and guess who's going to be the employees there? The Rite Aid people making $9 an hour.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, that's sad. Sad.
Get what's going on here? Hey, we've got Don. Don's calling in from Los Angeles.
Ah,
Don, hi, you're on the air.
Peter, Julene, hi, how you doing?
Hi, Don.
Oh, hey, I just wanted to comment on something that struck me through the last election cycle or two. It seems there's a sudden sense of urgency on the side of the right. You know, of course, they've always wanted their way to push the corporate agenda and push legislation that favors the rich, but now it's like, we want it now, and as we've just seen, we're prepared to nuke the entire country's finances in order to get it. What's changed?
Well, I think this is all prep for 2012. I mean, Obama has looked so bad now. I mean, because they're eroding his support from all different angles. And this does. This severely erodes the support he has from the base. I can't believe how many people I know that have said, you know, I'm not voting for this guy next time. I mean, if they put up Michelle Bachmann or maybe even Mitt Romney, they'll probably go, well, I guess I will. But I'll tell you, with my friends, you know, it's on a Tuesday and it's when we play handball, and if it's, if it's a choice between handball and voting, they might not show up. They're so disappointed in Barack Obama that he hasn't shown the kind of fortitude necessary to stop the assault the Republicans are carrying out on the average person. So this is all, this whole debt ceiling manufactured crisis, which never had to be, which was a total fake run by the Republicans. The debt ceilings are always just raised, we were saying earlier, almost like 100 times or 78 times.
78, yeah.
And a whole bunch of Reagan raised the debt ceiling 18 times just himself. You know, that they wanted this constitutional crisis, and this is opening the door for 2012. Mitch McConnell, the senator from Kentucky, said, my job number one, make sure, job number one, that's what he said, make sure that President Barack Obama does not get reelected. Not create jobs, not make this a better country, defeat Barack Obama. I just got time for a couple more calls. So, Don, thanks for calling
some
far away.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for joining us. As ZZ Top sings, we're bad, we're nationwide. Yeah. Here's Tim in Kalamazoo. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I was wondering, did you guys reference NBC in your conversation?
Yeah.
Who owns NBC?
GE.
Who owns GE?
Who owns GE? Tell me.
Jeffrey Immelt.
You mean this is an individual stockholder? I mean, more than one person owns General.
Well, he runs.
Oh, he's
GE.
Oh, the CEO.
Yes.
Yeah. Sure.
And who's Barack Obama's best buddy that's been to the White House more times than you can count on your hands and your feet, maybe times two.
He remembered that Barack Obama was going there and complimenting GE at the same time that GE isn't.
No, he's been to the White House as his buddy.
No, I know. But what I was saying that I thought it was scurrilous that he was using, I forgot what way, there was some public meeting, and then GE winds up paying no income tax whatsoever, and again, they have record taxes. But we're almost out of time. What's
so there's not a conflict of interest between Obama,
Oh, you think they're giving
NBC?
You think they're giving him a free ride? You think they're giving him a free ride?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, well, you know what?
Yeah.
I don't even want to necessarily disagree with
right.
you. I mean, because, you know what? If GE thinks that their interests are best served by supporting a Democrat, they'll do that. I mean, it's all a scam. I mean, I agree. All right, thank you. Got to do these real quickly. Chris in Farmington Hills, give me just some headlines because we're almost out of time. Hey, Chris.
Chris.
Hi, how's it going?
Hey.
Going good.
I was just wanting to... A guy a few calls ago, he was saying something about, we should be more understanding of the rich people, and they're smarter than us, so we should really respect them. And,
yeah.
I thought he was being funny at first.
Yeah, me too. I just got to say, I mean, this guy has got to be completely blind to the fact that it's not the rich people. The rich people can be defined in a couple different ways, and one of them, ways I think he thinks is if you're someone that makes, you know, if you have a business and say you make $1 million or $2 a year, that's one thing. That's not rich. That's
right.
I mean, yeah, that's rich for an individual, but we're talking about people that make, you know, 50 million, 100, 2. I mean, these people that are billionaires that really kind of control the country and everything that's going on it right now.
Sure. Yeah, that's kind of what I was trying to explain, but people just don't hear that part. Sorry I have to yell.
I mean, there's so many of these people out here that think, I made $2 million last year, and I'm really being screwed because I have to pay more in taxes, and it's not those people that...
Well, also, you know, those right. people are maybe paying less taxes than they ever had since the income tax amendment was passed back in whenever it was, 1913 or 14. People making $1 million a year income are in the top 1% of the population. I mean, they're a pretty small little crowd. But together, that top 10%, 5%, and particularly 1/10 of 1% own so much and control so much, it is absolutely extraordinary. All right, thanks a lot. Here's Willie in Farmington Hills. Willie, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you? I just want to say you guys are truly a breath of fresh air.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
But a couple points I'd like to make. First of all, it's a Tea Party. I'm kind of wondering what their demographics are, because I was watching a rally one day, and they appear to be just normal people who aren't really terribly rich. And
they're mostly white, about 99.9% white, and they are mostly middle class. They receive all sorts of government benefits. They always make a big deal if they have African Americans. Oh, look, there's an African American. How can you say we're, you know, a pack of racists? Or, you know, they get some working class guy and say, hey, you know, he's in a union. But mainly there are these people who are they're sort of on the edge in a lot of ways, and are expressing a kind of organized anger that if they were more constructive would make some sense. I mean, unfortunately, though, they are organized. The only reason they're able to organize is because they have these billionaires backing them, particularly the Koch brothers, KOCH, for anybody who'd like to Google them, and heading them off not in the direction of that'll solve their problems or secure their future, which they're sincerely worried about, but rather create more wealth for these already wealthy people. All right, Willie, I got to go. Unfortunately, got to end this section of the program. Tim, my apologies. We'll get you on next week.
Next week.
Jalene Jordan, thank you. Athena, Sarah,
thank you so much for your help.
In about 11 hours, we'll have a podcast of this up. You can go to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/nightcall. Friends wanted, join in the discussion. And hey,
keep fighting the good fight.
And we'll do it all next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
The place
to take to the sky with 101 The Rift. Listen to score your very own land card, along with VIP passes and parking to the Selfridge Air Show and Open House, as well as tickets to the air show landing party featuring Eddie Murphy. One lucky Rift winner will score the ultimate man card adventure, taking flight in an aerobatic performance plane with pilot Brad Hunter, getting twisted and turned inside out. Grand prize winner must be 200 pounds or less. More info at selfridgeairshow.org. Listen and win from 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Everything that rocks. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, I think all of you by now have heard the term peak oil. And we'll talk a little bit about that and what it means and whether the predictions that we've hit kind of a plateau and are beginning to go down on the other side of oil and other resources that could start resource wars. We've talked about that on this program as well. That phrase, peak oil, is associated correctly in many ways with my guest, Richard Heinberg. Richard Heinberg is a senior fellow of the Post Carbon Institute in Santa Rosa, California, and he's at his office. We're going to be speaking with him. The last time we spoke, I'm trying to look through his many books. I would just Google Richard Heinberg or go to richardheinberg.com. But I believe we spoke with him about blackout coal, climate, and the last energy crisis. And for sure, the party's over. Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies. Richard Heinberg has a new book out, extraordinarily important if we want to get a real fix on what we're facing. And it's much more than just the surface thing that's roiling the political system currently. The book is called The End of Growth, The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality by Richard Heinberg. It's published by New Society Publishers. Richard Heinberg, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's good to be with you.
The end of growth. People go, what? We got to have growth. Capitalism depends on growth. I mean, the whole problem is we're not consuming enough. How can we have the end of growth?
Yeah, well, the problem is we live on a finite planet, and nothing grows forever within a bounded system. Our economy depends ultimately on resources, on energy and materials. And those are limited. We've been using fossil fuels for the last couple of hundred years to fuel economic growth. And we're not about to run out of fossil fuels. There's still lots of oil left in all sorts of places around the world, including more here in the U.S. that we haven't extracted. But the problem is we go about our process of resource extraction using the low-hanging fruit principle. We get the easy-to-access, cheap to produce, high quality stuff first, and leave the nasty, hard to produce, expensive stuff for later. And guess what? It's later.
Yeah.
That's why oil is selling for $100 a barrel right now rather than $20 a barrel, which is what the U.S. Department of Energy forecast a decade ago that it would cost now. And it's why we're seeing rising prices of almost all commodities, everything from wheat and corn to copper, indium, gallium, everything from antimony to zinc.
Yeah, it isn't, though, in an artificial market that if the oil market is controlled, it's like diamonds, right? If they put all of the oil out that is available, we'd be back to paying 25 cents a gallon.
Well, actually, that can't be done. It's the rate of production is controlled by the amount that actually can be produced on any given day. Saudis, for example, claim that they would be able to produce another couple of million barrels a day over and above what they are producing. But if they really did that, that would harm their oil fields. They would that would result in less ultimately recoverable oil from their fields. So in order to husband their resource they've decided to only produce about 9 to 10 million barrels a day. Meanwhile, their domestic consumption is rising. So by, 2025 or something, even if Saudi Arabia continues producing as much oil as they are now, they won't be exporting any because they'll be using it all domestically. And this is one of the problems that's not often discussed when people talk about the oil markets. It's not just a matter of total production, which has been stagnant since about 2005, but it's also a problem of net exports, which actually have been declining over the past 5 years.
Well, we're always told about Venezuela and it having this huge recoverable field of oil. And I know when I was in Caracas, when was it, about 5 years ago, gasoline was literally cheaper than water. It was, I forgot what, like 18 cents a gallon. And that's what people expect. So that's heavily subsidized.
Exactly, yes. And a number of other oil-producing countries subsidize their domestic market, which, of course, results in people within those countries using gasoline or oil products, more profligately than they otherwise would if they had to pay the world rate. They wouldn't use as much. So that compounds the problem for everybody else.
The book is The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. And Richard Heinberg, what's our new economic reality?
Well, our new economic reality is a contracting economy, whether we like it or not, and almost no matter what we do. We've reached not only limits to cheap energy and cheap resources, but also we've reached limits to debt. Over the last few years, since 2008, our economy has been in really bad shape. But it's really been held aloft mostly by large deficit spending on the part of government. Take that away, and there really hasn't been any GDP growth. We've had about $700 billion of GDP growth, and we had, stimulus packages of about $700 billion. So what's actually happening now, of course, is that we're running out of the ability to continue racking up more government debt and deficits. And so almost inevitably the economy is going to relapse. Now, of course, the Republicans say, well, if we shrink government, then private enterprise will just take up the slack and start creating jobs and so on. There's really no basis for that. Household net worth is still declining as house prices decline. And the workforce is aging. People are nearing retirement. They want to save more and borrow and consume less. There's really no basis for a recovery in the conventional sense. People are, pulling back rather than plunging ahead with more borrowing and spending. And with 70% of the economy being consumer driven, that just means, as I said, there's really no basis. But you combine these two things, you combine the limits to debt with limits to natural resources, and the conclusion is we've reached a fundamental turning point in economic history. If the 20th century was all about growth, we had a couple of hiccups there, the Great Depression, a couple of world wars and so on, but generally the 20th century was a manic period of industrial expansion driven by cheap fossil fuels. Well, the 21st century is not going to look like that at all. It's going to be a time of cutting back, of economic contraction. And if we don't plan for that, it's going to be tragic. It doesn't have to be one long, horrendous experience. If we adapt, it could be okay. We've been through hard times before, but the reason I wrote the book is I'm concerned that we're facing this economic transformation, but we're not planning for it adequately.
Well, Richard Heinberg, let me pose an alternative to what you're saying. I can imagine many people on the left say this. Yes, we've reached peak oil. There could very well be Resource Wars, Michael, why am I all of a sudden blanking on
Michael Clare, yeah.
Michael Clare, who I've interviewed, you know, says that that's in our future. We can offset that with alternative energy, and that that once we have a proper allocation or distribution of income, we're not going to have that problem. In other words, that we've got the top 400 wealthiest people in this country for the first time are all billionaires. There's trillions of dollars of compacted wealth. And if there was a great redistribution of wealth, that would deal with a lot of the problems that we're facing. And consumers all over the world consume like they do in Detroit suburbs.
Well, you know, I agree that unless we have more economic equity, this is going to be a very, very difficult transition. And what's been happening over the past 3 or 4 years since 2008 is essentially that the super wealthy class made a lot of bets over the past decade, and those bets came in the form of securitization and derivatives, and those bets went sour big time back in 2008. And so the risk and the debt has been transferred from those super wealthy institutions and people to the general public. And that's what all of these austerity packages are all about. It's making sure that the bankers get paid and then the taxpayers will have to make up the difference over the long haul.
Yeah, they made the problem, and they expect everyone else to pay for it. In the meantime, they're doing just super well. I was just reading in the New York Times today how these multi-million-dollar properties in Miami are suddenly, after all these foreclosures there, that being, you know, one of the highest areas of foreclosure, they're suddenly selling rapidly. Sales up, you know, like a couple hundred percent. So there's a third of the economy and a third of the people that occupy that space have quote recovered. And the problem is the bottom two thirds. In fact, I don't know if you know the economist Richard Wolff. Are you familiar with him at all?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I interviewed him and I said, you know, I wanted to check with you because I said that I always say on my programs that there's going to be this Guatemala or Mexican model, that a third of the population will be well waged, and that's where commodity production and circulation will take place. That really drives the economy. The bottom two thirds will actually, you know, be by the side of the road selling coyote fences. And he said, no, I don't agree with you. And I said, oh, really? And he said, yeah, it'll be more like 10%. Well, I mean, that's the worst case scenario, of course.
Yeah.
But
that is the direction in which we're headed. See, the assumption has been that the economic pie will continue to grow and grow and grow, and even if the distribution is unequal, everybody will ultimately benefit. You know, the rising tide will lift all boats.
Right.
But because Earth's resources are limited, and our population and our consumption have been growing for so long now, we've gotten to a point where the total pie can't grow any longer. And so that means that the competition for who gets a bigger slice is probably going to get that much more fierce. Now this is the thing. We can deal with a static sized pie or even a shrinking pie if we're willing to share, if we're willing to make equitable sacrifices and cutbacks. But if we're all fighting over the crumbs, then this is going to be a really tough century to go through.
The book is The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. My guest is Richard Heinberg on The Peter Werbe Show. Richard Heinberg, probably best known for enunciating the theory of peak oil, but we're talking now about peak everything, is that there's nowhere to go forward with. I don't know whether you know, and I probably, now that you, I keep saying this, and you probably know everyone that I know, but Detroit's Grace Boggs, who has written about this, will be the first. She talks about revolution, but not armed revolution or not violence, not certainly not authoritarian. She's the opposite of that. A 95-year-old activist who says that the next American Revolution will be the first one in which material plentitude will be reduced. Now, that's not very appealing to people because most people want to work. They think, okay, my kids are going to do better. We're going to be able to get, instead of 3 televisions, we're going to be able to get 5, and they're going to be, instead of 56 inches, they're going to be 86 inches, and we're going to have 9 cars and lots of stuff that go beep. But the idea that we would all reduce our, what the conservatives would say, that these guys, the Richard Heinbergs, the Peter Werbys of the world, want to reduce our standard of living, and we have to say guilty to that? Is that true?
Well, what I'm saying is our standard of living is going to be reduced whether we like it or not. Now, again, that doesn't have to be a tragedy. You know, Americans consume more than just about anybody else on the planet, but it doesn't really make us any happier. If you look at studies of people's sense of happiness and security and satisfaction in life, studies that go back decades, you know, since 1950, Americans haven't actually gotten any happier or more satisfied, but our consumption levels have skyrocketed. And we've been told by advertising, by media, that all we have to do is consume more and we'll be happier. Well, it doesn't really work that way. What actually makes people happy is if they're doing things that are meaningful to them, if their work is somehow meaningful, if their relationships are sound, if they have an environment that is not toxic to them and is beautiful, then people are happy. And it doesn't require high consumption levels to have those things. So we really need to start targeting a different kind of trajectory for our society, rather than just targeting GDP growth all the time, which is just the, you know, the aggregate spending in the economy. We have to start targeting quality of life indicators. And if we do that, you know, we can actually have a better way of life, even as we're consuming less.
Richard Heinberg, flesh out the pronoun we. I mean, because this is a corporate society. It's run by and for corporations, essentially. We have a modicum of democracy that allows you and I to discuss publicly dissenting views. We can do a lot of things you can't do in countries that don't have full democracy. Yet they're pretty much as an oligarchy of a plutocracy, a small people running things for the ultra wealthy. And so both the political system and certainly the people that benefit from things as they are, and they are benefiting richly right now, who's the we? I mean, you and I can, you know, get rid of our garbage disposal or something like that. But how does that I wasn't going to quote Dick Cheney earlier, but I will quote him now. He said, those are just gestures. I mean, sometimes I'm about gestures, but what we want is policy, something that actually impacts. So who's the we when we talk about doing things differently?
Well, on our current trajectory, the sacrifice is being felt by the poor and middle classes, and those at the top of the economic pyramid are not sacrificing at all. They're making out like bandits. If that doesn't change, we are going to see society unravel. We are going to see more and more social unrest. What's been going on in Greece and Spain and a few other countries in the Eurozone is just a foretaste of what we will see here in the U.S.
I don't know if you saw the Wall Street Journal the other day. It said the rich fear growing violence, and they're afraid of essentially not class war, because that actually suggests some sort of consciousness, but rather just random violence against the wealthy like there was in the 18th century.
Right. Well, they're right to be afraid of that, because, you know, as society simply can't bear for long the levels of inequality that we're seeing today. In history, every time societies have even approached these levels of inequality, there have been, you know, revolutions, wars, and so on. So it's just not good for us as a people to have such disparity in incomes and wealth. So, you know, I would say to politicians, if I could speak to you know, the President Obama or folks in the Congress right now, look, you know, as long as you promise more economic growth, you are going to be leading people astray, and they are going to come back at you. We have to start promising things we actually can deliver, which is a better quality of life. But in order to do that, we're going to have to start making some arrangement, different arrangements in our economic system. We're going to have an honest discussion about, you know, just how much economic inequality we can bear as a society and how much is good for us.
Richard Heinberg, you're a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, and we're talking in your office in Santa Rosa, California. In that post carbon, you know, beyond oil, beyond coal. And yet here we, I don't even know if we can call this the Motor City anymore, and the majority of cars aren't made here any longer. But the expansion, for instance, as a middle class begins to grow in India and China, the demand for cars is growing exponentially. A number of American automobile companies making great money over there, and they have their own brands as well. What is it going to mean to have a motorized world?
Well, you know, I think that's a trend that is not going to go on much longer, quite frankly. China's economy is actually much more fragile than we're being led to believe. It's an economy that it's a bubble economy. They're building whole cities that are completely uninhabited because people can't afford to actually live there. They have a real estate bubble, sound familiar, in China, an enormous one. And it's a country that's entirely dependent on coal as a sort of, not entirely, but 70% of their energy comes from coal. And they're using 3.5 times as much coal right now as the U.S. Meanwhile, their coal reserves are only a fraction of U.S. coal reserves. So this is something that's not going to go on much longer, I don't think. And in any case, you know, as global oil supplies start to shrink and the price of fuel goes up, it's going to make all forms of transportation more expensive. Now, yes, we can have more electric cars, and that's a good idea, but it'll be decades before electric vehicles are a very large proportion of the overall fleet. And during that time, we are just going to become less mobile as a society.
You mean just because I didn't understand, I guess, the last. Why are we going to be less mobile?
Yeah, well, we will have fewer transport options, and they will be more expensive. You know, we're not going to have electric airliners. it is possible to run, 747s partly on sophisticated biofuels, but that's very expensive fuel.
Yeah.
And as conventional jet fuel gets more and more expensive, we'll see terminals being shut down, fleets being mothballed, and 20 years from now, rather than having more and more people flying, we will have fewer and fewer.
Yeah, I was just looking at airfares out your way from Detroit to San Francisco, and the first fare I got on Delta was $750 round trip, and this was like, you know, for a month from now, and I'm thinking, Yeah, so again, that's going to be where a person that doesn't think twice about it. So everything is going to be, to some extent, rather than growth, miniaturized. But I wonder, you know, it's odd. Does this play into the hands, the end of growth, adapting to our new economic reality, where you have virtually the desire with good parts of the political system wanting to go back to the 19th century to forget about all the reforms of the 20th that so many people fought and literally died for? And right. And as I said, I'll go for my Guatemala model, and the third of the population being well-waged, that bottom two-thirds just always scrambling, precarious labor, all of that. Doesn't this, in a way, say that affirms that, in a way? They say, okay, yeah, we won't have machines that go beep. Well, we won't have a car. We won't. We'll have an 18-inch television.
Right. Well, you know, not having those things doesn't necessarily mean a life of misery. There are plenty of people in the world who don't have cars or gadgets and still have perfectly happy, meaningful lives. But, you know, if you have a society where some people have those things and way, way more, and other people have absolutely nothing, that's not a sustainable situation, socially speaking. You know, it tends to lead to not just social unrest, but violence and revolution. So the folks who are in charge, the folks who are living it up right now, the billionaires, really need to be thinking very carefully about what future they really want. You know, if what they're imagining is that we can go back to the 19th century era of robber barons, and everyone else is just going to say, "Oh, okay, well, that's fine. That's what that's not in the cards." Mm-hmm. They're living in a fantasy land.
Let me. Do we just have 60 seconds left with Richard Heinberg? Is this totally a wrist slitter conversation, or is there hope?
Oh, of course, there's hope. And you know, in the book, the last couple of chapters, I talk about not only what policymakers can and should do, but also what ordinary folks can do to begin to adapt to this new historical era. You know, if we get to know our neighbors, if we proactively reduce our consumption and start concentrating on those aspects of our lives that really do make us happy, you know, we can get through this. We as a people, we've been through a depression and two world wars just within the last century. We know what hard times are, and we can survive them. But we're not going to survive them just by hunkering down in our own bunkers with our, you know, automatic weapons. That's not going to do it.
Well, thank you so much for being on the broadcast. The book is The End of Growth, another very important book by Richard Heinberg. The subtitle is Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. It is published by NewSociety.com. It's by New Society Publishers. That what I just said is their website. You can also go to RichardHeinberg.com, H-E-I-N-B-E-R-G. Or you could literally type in Peak Oil Richard and you would get it if you're having trouble with names like Heinberg and Verba, like mine. Also, it'll be at my website, PeterWerbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, the link will. Richard Heinberg, as usual, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Well, thank you so much, Peter. It's great talking with you.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Who's watching your home when you're not there? It could be a burglar. Burglars prefer to break in when they think no one is home and no one will stop them. Don't be an easy target for intruders. Protect your home with a free security system monitored by ADT, the leader in home security. Pick up your phone now and get free hardware, free medical and fire alerts, and free activation. It's an $850 value. Just call Protect Your Home, your authorized ADT dealer, at 1-877-653-8844. You'll get 24-hour protection, and there's no cost for parts or activation. Call now about a free security system monitored by ADT. Call 1-877-653-8844. $99 installation charge, 36-month monitoring agreement at $35.99 per month. Call for terms and conditions to this offer and protect your home license numbers. Call now, 1-877-653-8844. That's 1-877-653-8844.
Policies issued by American General Life Insurance Company, Houston, Texas. Not available in all states. For details, visit MatrixDirect.com.
Sometimes I worry about what would happen to my family if I lost my job. But I never really thought about what would happen to them if they lost me and I didn't have life insurance. My cousin's husband died, and now she might have to sell her house just to make ends meet. I don't ever want to put my wife through that. So I called Matrix Direct.
Hi, I'm Brent Langdon for Matrix Direct. We partnered with American General Life to find you their lowest rates on term life insurance products. If you're 40 years old and married, we could find you a $250,000 policy for less than $16 a month. Call now for a free, no-obligation quote. 1-800-916-1059.
I feel so much better now that I called.
It only takes 5 minutes to see how you could save up to 70%. Call now. 1-800-916-1059. 1-800-916-1059.
Do you have a disability that prevents you from working? Then you may be entitled to collect thousands of dollars of Social Security benefits. If you've been medically disabled for at least 12 months and previously worked 5 of the last 10 years, you may qualify to receive thousands of dollars paid directly to you every month. Just call Disability Benefits Alliance at 1-877-941-8822. Disability Benefits Alliance can cut through government red tape and help you receive Social Security disability.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. The question of race, it's something that's been with us since the origins of this nation, since the Euro-Americans came here, bringing slaves very early on. Slavery enshrined, unfortunately, in the Constitution of this country, the foundation document, a necessity to have a union with the southern states that held people as chattel slaves. Through the Civil War, of course, the states' rights that they talk about was the states' right to hold people in chattel slavery, people of African descent. A civil war in which more Americans lost their lives than all the rest of the American wars combine, then segregation, then the civil rights movement, and perhaps one would say the final resolution of this with the election of a black man to the highest office in the land, Barack Obama. So, done deal, right? We should move on. Post-racial, I mean, who's going to still talk about race, except we know there's a few crackpots among us, but those are the people that don't like gays and don't think women should be in the workplace and all that. So they're a tiny minority, or are they? And what's the deal here? Well, a book from a man who has just done so much with this question. The book has come my way. It's called Colorblind: The Rise of Post-Racial Politics and the Retreat from Racial Equity. The author is Tim Wise. It's published by City Lights Book. And Tim Wise is an anti-racist essayist, an educator, and activist, and he's written four previous books, one which I've read, White Like Me, Reflections on Race from a Privileged Son. We reached Tim Wise at his home in Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you very much.
Well, all that said, most people think, well, yeah, you know, the only people that are still talking about race are those older folks who can't get over it, and perhaps people that quote, play the race card. In other words, we're over that. Would you say no?
Well, you know, the thing is, we have to put this in some historical context. I mean, all of the periods that you were mentioning in the intro, talking about the history of racism in our country, during all of that period, white Americans by and large, and I'm one, white Americans by and large didn't think there was a problem even then. I mean, you can go back to the early 60s and look at Gallup polls in 1962 and 63 at a time when, in retrospect, we all know we were a profoundly unequal, really apartheid country, and yet the vast majority of whites, between two-thirds and almost 90%, depending on the way the question was worded, told Gallup pollsters that black folks had fully equal opportunity with white folks. So even when it was blatant, most whites didn't see a problem. So I think we have to keep in mind, just because folks don't see it, don't think it's a problem, that's always been true. And in every generation, whites have said that and have been wrong.
Well, Tim Wise, you're in your material I get with this, it says you've spoken to hundreds of thousands of people, contributed essays or chapters to more than 20 books, right, and that you've been doing this for 20 years.
Right.
As a white male, as a, what I sometimes call a Euro-American, why not take care of some other biz in this country?
Well, for the same reason that there have been white folks all the way through American history, going back to the colonies before we were even a country, who realized that racial inequity against peoples of color, our brothers and sisters on this continent and really around the world, is something which not only harms them and is a moral and ethical issue, but frankly weakens the fiber of the society in which we live. I mean, the history of racism in the United States has made us a worse off place. I live in the South and have grown up here, and you know, even if you're up in a place like Detroit or Chicago or New York or anywhere in the country, you can see the way that racial division and racial inequity has harmed everyone. It ultimately brings down the strength of the economy in the South. You know, we've had weaker labor unions and weaker working class solidarity because white folks were so busy trying to keep black folks out of the neighborhood or try to keep Latino folks off the job that they ultimately undermined the ability of working people to come together and fight for better wages for everybody, fight for better health care, better benefits. So really, racism and racial inequality and an ongoing racial disparity, robs the whole country, including those of us who are white in the long run, of the economic, the cultural, the social vitality that we'd otherwise have. So I think it's very much something that white Americans need to think about and care about.
Well, you're posing it to some extent, and understandably, in self-interest, that everyone has a self-interest in equality for making what this country says it's about actually be about. Is there an ethical and moral consideration to this? Because certainly the people, the whites who were in the anti-slavery movement before the Civil War, and the people that acted against segregation, the whites involved, the people that went to the South, lost their lives, were jailed and all that, they in many ways were motivated not at all by thinking, well, wait a minute, we're getting hurt by racism. There is a profound ethical component to this.
Oh, I think there is, and I don't think they're in any way in conflict with each other. I mean, the activist of the civil rights struggle and the abolitionist movement did, in fact, I think, understand the commonality of interest and even the so-called self-interest. But the ethical piece is huge. I mean, for us to stand by, for any human being to stand by, while other of our human family are being oppressed and marginalized and given less opportunity than we have, is to implicate us in that tragedy. And I think the ethical piece for me is that you can't be an innocent bystander when others are being marginalized, whether it's on the basis of race or whether it's on the basis of class or gender or sexual orientation, because at any given point, that could be us. And if we believe that ethically we would want folks to stand with us, then we have to be prepared to stand with them. And I think in the very short period of time that we have on this earth, there are very few ways to sort of earn one's life, to earn one's time on this planet. And I think fighting for justice and fighting for equity is certainly a pretty good way to spend at least some of that time. And thankfully, there have been people throughout the history of our country and other countries who have done that. And some have been, obviously, most have been, when it comes to race, have been of color. But there have also been hundreds and even thousands of whites who have done the same.
Well, I think you know the book by the historian Howard Zinn. It's called "You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train." So that's always an important concept. The book is Colorblind: The Rise of Post-Racial Politics and the Retreat from Racial Equity. Well, certainly one thing that you hear when and it's peculiar if you're a white person, that oftentimes people that hold racialist or racist views, maybe we can even, if you think there is a difference, get into what the difference is, that doesn't occur to them that that you might not hold those same prejudicial views, and they'll frequently speak their mind quite openly, something they wouldn't do in a mixed situation or even in a work situation.
Right.
But
right.
But that is that, we're talking about a people that, that the call that Tim Wise, you and other people, myself, are uttering actually is special pleading for people of color. Look, we've had the civil rights movement. We have a black president. This winds up to still be, like an excuse, the race card. You've heard all this. So how do you look at that?
Well, in the book, I have a significant portion of the book, the second chapter, most of it actually, details in great detail with substantial footnotes, studies, references, the evidence which suggests that racial discrimination is not something which was a problem 30, 50, 100, 200 years ago, but is in fact ongoing in housing, employment, education, and in healthcare, and that the ongoing discrimination against people of color is robbing black and brown folks in this country of wages that they otherwise would have, wealth that they otherwise would have, and even health outcomes that they otherwise would have if they were being treated the same as whites. So indeed, not only is it not playing a race card, in fact, most of the time, we hear very little about the ongoing problem of racism. If anything, that's the card that we end up holding very close to the vest for fear that it won't be taken seriously, even though the evidence is overwhelming. I also think, in reference to what you said, the ability of members of the dominant group to downplay the problem or to say that, well, the president somehow, wipes the slate clean doesn't make any more sense than it would have made, let's say, if we were to go back to Pakistan in 1988, which was the year that they first elected a woman, Benazir Bhutto, to be the head of state. And then if someone were to have said back then, well, that just proves sexism is no longer a problem here in Pakistan, and girls and women are treated fully equally with men in Pakistan or England or Great Britain or Israel, all of which have had female heads of state. Clearly, it's not that it's meaningless for those places to have had a woman as the head of state, and it's not meaningless that we have a man of color here as president, but it certainly doesn't necessarily tell us anything about the larger systemic reality, and that's what I try to document in the book.
In Colorblind, published by City Lights, a wonderful publisher, by the way, and it's wonderful that your book is published by them. Let's go back to what you were saying about class and self-interest, that we all have a self-interest in living in an equitable society, but I'm not sure everyone sees it like that. If you have a class society where you have rich and middle class, working class and poor, the first way that the inequality of wealth and wages is going to be distributed is on the basis of race. Right. So in a period of economic contraction, people are losing their jobs. I mean, I could imagine that would occur to white people, the less competitors I have in the job market. You know, if we got rid of women, if we got rid of blacks, we got rid of gays, we got rid of Mexicans, it'd just be the white guys that got access to the jobs.
Well, that's certainly one way of looking at it, and historically it's certainly true when you don't have to compete against all the other folks. 100% of what's there is going to go to people like you. But the downside of that, really, is that when you have millions of people in your country who are, within the next, let's say, 30 years, going to be about half the population of the United States, if that half of the population continues to have one-tenth the wealth and the assets of the other half, twice the unemployment rate of the other half, three times the poverty rate of the other half, 9 years less life expectancy than the other half, the reality is you cannot maintain a healthy economy like that. You cannot possibly provide economic opportunity or a healthy civic society or economy for anyone, including white folks, when you have that level of disparity. Every study that has been done, I don't mean some of them, I don't mean most of them, I mean every single one around the world that has been done has found that the greater the level of inequality in a society, whether we talk in economic terms or caste or racial terms, the greater the overall problems that the entire society faces, the worse off everyone is in terms of health outcomes, in terms of life expectancy, in terms of the quality of education, in terms of economic sustainability. So really, even though it means more competitors, even though it means you don't get 100% of everything, the well-being of people of color is intimately bound up with the well-being of white folks. We just cannot sustain a healthy society, a healthy economy on the backs of white people alone. It just can't be done.
Well, one dreads the thought of what I call the Guatemala model. That is to say that a third of the people are well-waged. That's where the majority of work and commodity consumption circulates. You almost see the beginning of that now with that concept of Whitetopia, where white people are beginning to kind of get their own little enclaves so it'll all work there. And then the bottom two-thirds, which will probably include a lot of white people as well, whether is it sustainable? No, it's a prescription for having authoritarian government, police and army repression, assassinations, and all of that. But what you're talking about, Tim Wise, has almost a revolutionary content to it, which I am all in favor of. But getting people to see beyond the individual, their individual circumstance or their neighborhood or whatever is pretty tough. That's what you're about, right?
Well, it is tough. And look, we've got, all of us have been subjected to so much conditioning around these issues that it's going to take a lot of work for us all to undo it. And one of the points I try to make in Colorblind is that this isn't about the good people over here who get this already and the bad people over there who don't. Really, we've all been subjected to intense racial conditioning, intense stereotypes in media. I mean, the data, for example, that I cite in the book demonstrates that the overwhelming majority of white Americans and even large numbers of people of color have internalized anti-black bias and pro-white bias, even though outwardly they don't necessarily manifest overt racism. So if you do a survey, most white folks are not going to seem or answer questions in a way that demonstrates overt bias. But then when they've done and constructed these really quite interesting experiments and studies of subconscious bias, they find that we virtually all have internalized some of that because we've been hit with that since we were kids. To unlearn that is going to require some real conscious effort on our part. The good news is, and I cite this research in the book as well, the evidence and the studies have found that we can, in fact, fight that racial conditioning as long as we're conscious of just how severe it has been and as long as we are committed to checking it day in and day out throughout the course of our lives. So we can fight back against it, but you have to be aware of the problem before you can do that.
Well, the subtitle of your book, Colorblind, says the rise of post-racial politics and also the retreat from racial equity. When there are so many young people that seem to have successfully entered that era where they, you know, that we see these in statistics that this isn't an issue. Race, that your sexual orientation isn't an issue compared to, like, you know, the older folks.
Right. I think we have to be very careful, though. I mean, one of the studies that I cite in the book, and there are others that say the same thing, has found that although younger people are certainly more outwardly open-minded than their parents or grandparents' generation, when you get down to it, they have a significant amount of racial bias as well that they will express in private, perhaps not in public. So one study, for example, that was done by two sociologists who wrote a book about this 2 years ago, they actually had 626, I believe it was, college students around the country do an experiment where they were asked to keep journals for, I believe, like a six-week period or something. And during the course of that 6 weeks, the instruction was that they were to write down, these were white students, they were asked to write down every instance in that 6 weeks where someone in their social circle, a friend or a colleague or someone on the dorm hall floor at the college, made a racial comment, told a racist joke, or acted out in some way that was racist. At the end of the 6 weeks, they gathered up these journals, and these were just average everyday white folks. They weren't activists that were being asked to keep these things. It was just average students. When they turned in the journals and the sociologists looked through them, they were able to find 7,500 instances collected by these 626 people in just 6 weeks that were blatant. I mean, these weren't even close calls. These were blatant racist jokes, blatant racist comments, blatantly racist incidents that they had observed and witnessed. So we're talking about, for each of these young people, a couple of times a week amongst their peers seeing this kind of behavior. So it says to me that even the young, who maybe outwardly have learned how to keep that stuff tight and sort of close to the vest, that it's still very much a part of their conditioning too.
Racism is, or race, let me put it that way, it's a very strange thing. There was this little item in the media about President Barack Obama, who listed himself as an African American as opposed to mixed race. Usually ethnicity is traced through the mother, like, for instance, among the Jewish population, if you have a Jewish father and a Gentile mother, you are not Jewish. If you have a Gentile father and a Jewish mother, you're Jewish. Right. So Barack Obama, you know, why isn't he white? You know, that he had a white mother.
There are very specific religious, and I'm Jewish, and actually my mother is not Jewish, so I wouldn't be considered Jewish in Israel, I suppose. But but there are very specific sort of scriptural reasons and long-standing religious reasons that I don't happen to think are all that valid for why we in the Jewish community do that. But the reason that Barack Obama calls himself African American is the reason that most all folks who are a mix of, let's say, black and white do that, and that is because in the society, and we need to keep this in mind, race is not biologically very meaningful. I mean, the differences between us scientifically are very small, but socially, to be a mix, let's say, of white and black is almost always going to mean that offspring, that child, if they are dark enough to be seen as something other than white, will be treated as the non-white portion of their identity, because race socially is about how you're treated. It's not about what you are, quote unquote. I mean, I always love it during the campaign when people would say, well, Barack Obama, you know, he's just as white as he is black. Well, yes, in terms of lineage, but not socially, because, and here's the example I use, you know, Barack Obama went to Columbia University for the last 3 years of his undergraduate college degree, and the only way that it would be true to say that he is just as black or just as white as he is black is if you can envision him standing out on a corner in Harlem, where Columbia is located, trying to catch a taxi cab to go downtown to Greenwich Village, and 50 out of 100 times that he did that, the cabbie looked at him and said, wow, look at that white guy, and the truth is, that isn't going to happen. Sure. Barack Obama would be seen socially as black, or at least as a man of color. And so because of that social truth, most people of color who are of quote-unquote mixed parentage or mixed lineage will choose to identify as people of color because they understand that socially that is how they've experienced the society. It's not really disrespectful to the mom. He has written glowingly about his mother, about his grandparents. But at the end of the day, he knows that socially to be black and white in this country is to be black.
Which says, of course, that race is a social construction.
Right.
Yeah, that it's nothing permanent, indelible, or anything like that. The kind of attributes that we adhere to, it can be reversed. That's part of what your book, Tim Wise, Colorblind, is all about. Papa Doc Duvalier. I don't know if you've ever heard this anecdote about they asked him how many white, what percent of his, of Haiti was white. This must have been in the 1960s or so. And he said 90%. They said, no, no, we said white. He said, oh, no, we have the same theory as you do. If you have one drop of white blood in you, we consider you white. I mean, he was he was making fun of the idea that we, the single drop of blood concept here, which is biological nonsense as well. But socially, it's powerful, right?
Right. It's very powerful socially, and that's really the way in which it matters. And I want us to really understand that. You know, the reason that we have racial disparity in our society is because those people who have been identified as something other than white have been consistently, throughout the course of our country's history, given less opportunity, less access. And now we are reaping the outcome of that. I mean, we've just come out of a 20th century in which, and this is important for us to think about right now, the government of the United States intervened in the economy to not only hurt black and brown folks, but to benefit whites, intervened with the FHA and the VA loan programs that people of color were virtually excluded from the 30s through the early 1960s, in places like Detroit, in places like Chicago, all over the country. You had tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in housing equity being loaned preferentially to white working class families to help them become middle class at the very time that, that people of color were being barred from those efforts. And so we have to understand, and this is critical right now, as you have, you know, Tea Party folks running around saying, you know, that they just want small government. Well, the truth is, government was never small for those of us who were white. It always intervened on our behalf. It was only when the government began to intervene to try to equalize opportunity that suddenly a lot of white Americans discovered their inner libertarian and decided they loved the free market. The free market is not what white folks were relying on with the GI Bill, the FHA, the VA loan, the Homestead Act, all of these things that government did to provide access and opportunity to some, even as it denied it to others.
Tim Wise, we just have a few minutes left. You've spoken to hundreds of thousands of people about race. So what is the, when I don't know if this you can assemble this, but what the most disturbing trend and the most heartening trend when you speak to people directly?
Well, the most heartening trend is that I am seeing over the last 10 to 15 years an increasing number of folks, including white folks, who are willing to really examine this issue of institutional racism and even their own white privileges to try to create and really push for a more equitable society. I'm seeing a lot of that among younger folks and even not so young folks. So that's obviously a heartening thing. On the bad side of things, you know, I think we're experiencing sort of a perfect storm for white racial anxiety right now that folks like the Tea Party folks are taking advantage of, not just the black president and a faltering economy, but also a demographic shift that in 30 years, as I said before, will make the country about half white, half of color, which for white folks, you know, for some white folks is very scary because it sort of, you know, unsettles our notion of what an American is. We've had the ability to think of ourselves as the prototypical American, and now we're having to share that designation with people who not only look different, sound different, pray different, maybe their first language is not our first language, and so there are some white folks for whom that is unsettling. And then we have a popular culture that is thoroughly multicultural and looks very different than the one a lot of white folks used to be used to. So I think when you put all that together, it is a particularly combustible combination that folks like the Tea Party with their, you know, I want my country back mantra are prepared to take advantage of, whether they use overtly racial themes to do it or just subtly coded racial themes. So that obviously disturbs me.
I don't think the 1990s were the golden age, but certainly it's been mythologized as such. But since September 11th, there's increasing, I think, social exhaustion and anxiety. And now, of course, the anxiety about the economy is so great that asking people, asking white people to take on something else that doesn't even on the face of it, although I think you've eloquently spoken to why it is, to take on yet another crusade, I don't know. I mean, in some ways, I'm not very hopeful about it, but I mean, I'm hopeful that people pick up your book, Colorblind, and begin to consider those things. But what would you say to those people that just say, well, one more storm, as you said?
Absolutely. Look, I know there's only 24 hours in a day and 7 days in a week, and that doesn't change, so it's hard to take on new stuff. But I will say this, and this is something to think back on as we move forward. Had we, let's say, as a country, 15 years ago, when the subprime housing market crisis began to emerge in black communities and in Latino communities and in poor communities, and that's when it started. 15 years ago, this stuff was beginning, and people were warning about it, and a lot of folks said, well, that's not me, it's not my neighborhood, you know, it doesn't affect me, that's their problem. And And so we sort of turned our eyes, and a lot of white folks and middle class and upper middle class folks, regardless of color, said, why do we need to care about other people as long as we've got ours? And I don't want to put one more thing on my plate. Well, 15 years later, we see that the rot of subprime lending in the mortgage market spreads throughout the economy and ends up hurting everyone. So the idea that we can afford to have this attitude of, you know, I'm not my brother's keeper, I'm not my sister's keeper, I don't have to worry about what happens on that part of town or in that city or in that community, I think is now being shown with this economic situation to be a faulty mentality. And so if we don't want to repeat the mistake that we're right now living through, we need to begin to embrace solidarity and start to realize that those folks' struggles are our struggles, and if we don't join them, we're all going to go down together.
The book is Colorblind, The Rise of Post-Racial Politics and the Retreat from Racial Equity. The author is Tim Wise, and it's you can go to citylights.com. It's published by City Lights Books. And you can go to Tim's blog at redroom.com. Search for him by author's name, W-I-S-E. It'll also be a link on my website, peterwerbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Tim Wise, thanks for joining me on the program.
You bet. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Right now, homes are more affordable than they've been in decades. And Quicken Loans has a mortgage program that will help you buy that perfect home. Call Quicken Loans right now. They can even introduce you to a local real estate agent that can guide you through the process step by step. With more than 25 years of helping American homeowners, Quicken Loans makes the process as easy as possible. With a streamlined approach and proactive updates, they provide you with the certainty you need to search for the home of your dreams. And highly trained Quicken Loans specialists are standing by, ready to help you take advantage of this incredible mortgage opportunity. So give Quicken Loans a call now. Call 888-249-1425. Find out how much home you can afford. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. Nationwide licensing number 3030. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. Call 888-249-1425. That's 888-249-1425.
How much will your next car repair cost? If you have premium auto protection, there's no worry. You'll never have to pay a car repair bill again. Car repairs are expensive. $3,000 for a new transmission or $4,000 for a new engine can really set you back. But not if you have premium auto protection. They'll cover the cost of your car repairs. You choose the repair shop and premium auto protection pays them directly. You'll never pay a car repair bill again. Premium covers your car, truck, or SUV repairs. And they offer free road service and rental cars. You get top quality service. Satisfaction guaranteed. If your car is less than 10 years old with less than 150,000 miles, call Premium Auto Protection for your free quote. You'll never pay a car repair bill again. Call 866-960-2525. That's 866-960-2525. 866-960-2525.
Everyone just listen up here, right?
More rock now. 101 WRIF.